Welcome everyone to today's Internet Seminar. Today is part of the Military Munition Support Services Internet Seminar Series. I believe this is the sixth one that they've done throughout the 2013 year. Today's session will look at case studies and lessons learned, and it's been sponsored by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. My name is Jean Balance. I'll be serving as one of the online moderators from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. I'm going to turn things over to our topic or session leader in just a moment. But before I do that, let me cover some very important instructions and reminders for those of you that are just signing on for the very first time. If you've not participated in a CLUIN seminar before, I'm going to direct you guys to the registration email and reminder that you would have received after signing up for today's session. That email should have had a complete set of instructions on how to join today's broadcast. It basically would have pointed you to something called the seminar homepage, which would have had a complete agenda for today's session, contact and bio information for our presenters and moderators, links to download the PowerPoint presentations, even links to share feedback after the live broadcast. If you're at that seminar homepage, though, I'm going to point you to something called the Go to Seminar button. It appears in the upper left corner. If you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself, and then you can join us in the live interactive room that we'll be using for today's webinar. Our entire broadcast is going to be delivered online using a tool called Adobe Connect, which will allow you to sit back and watch in real time as our presenters navigate through their materials through various locations. As I'm doing right now, they'll actually click through the slides for you. You can also listen to the entire broadcast online through the Adobe Connect room. Again, that online audio stream has been turned on for everyone. If you're hearing the audio twice, both on the phones as well as online, simply pick whichever method you feel most comfortable with and either hang up or turn down your speaker volume to cut out the online audio. If you have problems joining us in the Adobe Connect room or you prefer to follow along on phones, you can certainly do that. The entire presentation sets have been made available on the seminar homepage as an additional resource or link. You can download those and just kind of follow along manually. We encourage you to work with us to help troubleshoot any problems you might be having so you can be brought into that fully interactive Adobe Connect room. By default, audio is available online to all participants. If the volume sounds too low online, I'd encourage you to check your local volume settings. You may need to go into your sound control panel or simply boost the speaker output. Sometimes wearing a pair of headphones can dramatically help increase the volume level. If that still doesn't work, we have toll-free call-in information. We'll be more than happy to share that with anyone who needs it. If you do join us on the telephone lines, please note all participants will be globally muted. You will not be able to take yourself off of mute and ask the instructors a question on the phone lines. In order to submit your questions or comments, you're going to use something called the Q&A window. That appears in the lower right corner of your screen. There's already a welcome message from me, Jean Ballant. You can actually privately submit a comment, question, or even report a technical problem at any time using that Q&A window. Simply place your cursor into the thin white box or field in the bottom right corner. Start typing your text up, and then hit enter or press the cartoon bubble to the right, and that will privately submit your comment or question. If you've never used this before, feel free to test it out. Go ahead and say hello, type up a real quick test message. We want everyone to feel comfortable because that's the primary method by which you'll be submitting those questions and comments. You can type them up at any point in time. You don't need to wait, but we will hold the questions until designated breaks with each presenter, as well as a wrap-up Q&A discussion at the end. So type up your question, and then again, we'll hold them and read them out loud on your behalf when we take a break for Q&A. My entire session is being recorded and will be available for free replay and download. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to post these on the CLUIN website. For those of you that signed up, you will automatically get an email letting you know once the live broadcast, or pardon me, the recorded version of today's live broadcast is available for free replay. You'll also be able to forward that email on to anyone that you think will find it valuable. If you're interested in the previously hosted M2S2 webinars, feel free to take a look at the CLUIN archive page, which is shown on the bottom of my housekeeping slide. That is an active hyperlink. You can click on that and take a look at the nearly 510 seminars that we also have recorded up there that we've hosted here on the Cleanup Information Network. If you're having problems viewing the presentation material, there's a full screen button that appears in the upper right corner of the window showing the slides. You can click that once to make the slides bigger. If you need to shrink that back down, simply press the full screen button again. It'll shrink the slides back down to their normal size. You should see the Military Munitions logo in the upper right corner, just letting you know they sponsor today's session. You'll see a collection of related URLs just below that. Those are active hyperlinks. You can click those at any time, press the Browse To button, and open up those websites on your own computer. For those of you that want copies of the slides, you'll find that under Seminar Resources. If you're one of the lucky ones replaying today's broadcast for the archive, those hyperlinks are still active in the recorded version as well. And then just below that, the lower Q&A window in the bottom right corner of your screen. You can type up your questions or comments here, and then simply hit enter or press the cartoon bubble to privately submit them at any time. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to turn things over to my session moderators whenever you're ready to begin.
Thank you, Jean. My name is John Sykes. I am the facilitator for today's session, sitting in for Dwayne Ford. So if you were only in on this to hear Dwayne's presentations and discussion, I hope you won't be too disappointed. So on today's session, Gene, not advancing. Gene, I don't have control.
Okay, not a problem. I can click through for you.
All right. There you go. Thank you. So on today's episode, we've got a varied lineup of speakers for you, representing Army, industry, state regulatory perspectives, and the core. So I hope you're you get a lot out of these discussions today. We've got a lot of experienced people out there, and I want to thank all of them for putting all the time and effort into bringing you these presentations, and hope you get a lot out of it. Especially want to thank Deb Walker, who is the moderator for the session, and it took a lot of time to coordinate with the speakers and get their presentations in. Thank you, Deb. So next slide, Gene. So here's the agenda for today. And one special note for the agenda is we will try to keep everything on schedule in case there are people who are signing in to listen to particular speakers. So we'll take a break if we have a lot of time between speakers. Questions and answers, if we have time at the end of a particular session, you'll be allowed to, we'll ask some questions at that point. So feel free to get those questions in during the session, and if we don't get to questions during the session, there'll be a half hour of open questions at the end. So stay tuned for that, and send your questions in. Your questions also make this a much better experience for everybody involved. Next slide, Gene. So the big thing here for these things is we need you all to get the word out for these sessions. They've been very successful this year, and only because you guys are spreading the word. You need to be our ambassadors. We need your help and support into keeping these things going. Next slide. All right, so the big information here today for you is we are planning the FY14 sessions, and this is where we really need your help. So you can see here the next one is in October. The next sessions are in October. It's MMRP objectives, DQOs, and remedial action objectives. So if you have any ideas for topics, you have project case studies, lessons learned, examples, good and bad, experiences with these topics, please send us an abstract, send us an email, or give us a call, and we will coordinate with you on these types of topics. And registration is opening soon. So if you've missed the previous session, they are on the CLUIN website. Feel free to go, and they have been recorded, as Gene mentioned before, so you can sit and you can listen to those, or you can print the materials off and go through them yourselves. All right, Gene? So again, we need your expertise, your experience, your knowledge. Without that, these sessions aren't worth much. So we need you to call us, let us know what's going on, bring your ideas, and help us with these sessions in the future. Okay, Gene? All right. Response Division. Mr. Daniel has over 23 years of project and program management experience at various installations across the country. And we're going to hear what he has to say today. Mr. Daniel.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to the group. I do appreciate these sessions being put together by the Corps, because in these days of a new fiscal reality, travel, conferences, you can pretty much forget it. So this is a great way to put the get information out to the field in any of these cleanup topics we're talking about. As mentioned, I am the program manager for the Active Sites program, Active Sites Cleanup Program. So I'm going to focus my talk on the state of the Active Sites Military Munitions Response Program and all the issues we're facing and how we plan to address those issues over the next few years. The first couple slides, I want to kind of give you a picture of what we're dealing with within the Active Sites program, the scope of our program through a lot of statistics. I'm not going to overwhelm you with a bunch of charts, so I only got a few. But I did want to give you an idea of what we're dealing with in terms of the quantity, the size, the complexity of the sites we're going to be dealing with in MMRP. At this point, we have about a little over 400 sites left to investigate and take response actions at our installations. And that covers about 100 installations, including some guard sites that we're working with the National Guard on. If you look at that, the graphic, you can see that about 40% of the sites are small arms and maneuver areas, and those should be relatively easy to deal with. Small arms are going to be more in line with what we've dealt with in the IRP, the Installation Restoration Program, in terms of lead and other metals and PAHs at skeet ranges, that type of thing. So it'll be more, it'd be similar to what we've done there. And again, the relative size, as you see on the next chart, and again, complexity, the low complexity here, they should be no problem. Disposal areas make up and be investigated and defined pretty well in terms of the contents and actions to be taken on those sites. Majority of our sites, though, are the firing ranges and basically general UXO ordnance areas. Those two classes make up the most of our acreage and the most of our actual sites. The problem with those, you get into the varied terrain, forest, water ranges, mountainous areas, just areas that just aren't conducive to cleanup work, investigations or cleanup. The geology, interference with magnetometry, other geophysics techniques, and then just the incomplete site histories on these ranges. Range fans have moved over, and we were talking about some of these huge range areas. I think we'll be tripping over areas in the future. So there's a lot to be done on those to narrow the focus of those sites. And basically, when you start getting to some of the bigger ranges, and I'll go to the next slide, you can see the site size, the distribution of size that we're dealing with our MMRP sites. About a third of the sites are less than 10 acres. That's manageable in a cleanup perspective in terms of how we address those sites in terms of investigation as well as the cleanup. A lot of our small arms ranges fall into those categories of the smaller areas to be dealt with. A lot of those will just require dig and haul, possible soil stabilization remedies. So they should be pretty easy to take care of. A lot of the maneuver areas tended to be just that, maneuver areas, not much fire. But again, they'll have to be sorted out to determine if there are any particular areas within the maneuver areas that have to be dealt with in terms of munitions. Incorporates that one-third, but the two-thirds of the sites total are 100 acres or less. Those are still manageable from a characterization standpoint, depending on the type of terrain. All bets are off when you hit water ranges and when you hit mountainous and wooded terrain even. It's going to be difficult to go in and characterize the sites. But it's still manageable in terms of the size we're talking about. What I'm more concerned about is the one-third of the sites that are over 100 acres, and they range up to 476,000 acres. So you can see there's quite a bit of area out there we have to deal with on those types of sites. And again, most of those are those firing area, firing ranges and bombing ranges, basically. So those are going to be a lot harder to investigate, just the vast amount of space we're talking about. We're going to have to figure out a way to, you know, break those down into manageable pieces. Again, identify those firing areas, identify the impact areas within that large acreage. But you know, we do have that most of our acreage tied up into 37 sites. And I tell you, the majority of the acreage is at one installation, one huge site. But again, those are going to be the more difficult ones to address in terms of characterization and cleanup. Kind of leads me to, you know, limitations. Again, I talked about the vast acreage we're talking about. Talked about the you know, the terrain, the water ranges, geologic interference, just the overall state of the technology in terms of detection versus discrimination. Most of it's detection, not a whole lot of discrimination at this point. And basically, you know, we're not going to be overcoming these issues in the short term. There's going to be a long-term process here in terms of coming to final decisions on the cleanup sites, on these MRRP sites, and other issues, lack of remediation standard. These things are safety-driven. We're talking acute risks here, not the chronic risks we're dealing with under the IRP program, under Superfund-type programs. So this is more of a safety-driven program, and basically, in terms of the munitions constituents, we're just not seeing much there. We have a few sites where we have munitions constituents that will drive some cleanups. Most of that's going to be small arms, impact areas, OBOD areas. But again, not anywhere near the scale that the munitions, the safety issues will drive some type of response action. One of the things we really deal with quite a bit at our installations as well is the lack of clear land reuse. Without that, you know, focused, defined land use in terms of grading plans and building footprints, those types of things that would really drive the depth of the excavation, the aerial extent of the investigation, we can enter one of these sites and really not have a good feel for how much cleanup is needed. Again, it falls into that, you know, how clean is clean. Or how much clean is clean enough, basically, to support land reuse at those. And then finally, physical constraints. I mean, everybody can see that these days. It's not going to get any better. We're going to see cuts to our program, a lot of cuts to a lot of military programs, and we won't be immune to that. So basically, we're going to be in this for the long haul. Got a lot of acreage out there. We have to figure out the best way to deal with the risks. And it kind of gets me into my last slide. And what we're doing within the Army's active cleanup program for MMRP is looking more into the risk management end of things. Basically, we're looking to characterize and define and bound that area of risk. What is our risk, again, as much as possible, in terms of land use. That's what we're trying to do, is make sure that the land is safe for use by the Army, as well as where we have former ranges all in place as interim measures for the past 3 years, working with Baltimore District. So we're well on the way to getting land use controls in place at all these sites to at least flag these areas as areas of concern until we can get around to the full investigations and full response actions. So that was the first step in risk management. We're looking at surface clearance as a big part of our cleanup. Again, depending on that exposure scenario, we're looking here at some of that, the land use that's going on right now, the hunting, hiking, nature trail type activities on some of these big areas that may contain UXO. We have we've used hunter education programs at sites, but basically making sure that direct exposure is minimized to anything on the surface. What we do plan to do, though, in terms of prioritizing our sites, we use the MRSPP scoring system to prioritize, but part of that is looking at those areas we don't control. That's really going to feed into how it is going to be done, to make sure that we're taking care of those properties we no longer control first, or those properties on installation boundaries, within installation boundaries that have already been redeveloped or are in the process of being redeveloped, so that we're, again, prioritizing that that most probable direct exposure issue. Land use controls will be part of our for those properties. We'll have to put land use controls into the master planning and installations to make sure that they are flagged, and that when it does come time to reuse a piece of property, that presence of munitions, potential presence of munitions, will be taken into consideration, and appropriate construction site clearances is performed. But again, as I mentioned, until we have. And one final point, what we're trying to do here is, leave the back 40 alone. If you have no development plans, if there, if all you have is a hunting and possible trespassing, take care of the surface clearance. But there's no reason to go into some of these areas. A lot of them are pretty pristine areas. There's no reason to go digging around. So that's kind of what we're looking at here, is kind of leave that back 40 alone. You look at the probable targeted cleanup to support land reuse, or to support properties that have already gone out from Army's control to mitigate the risk associated with any munitions out there. We are addressing the risk part of this. But if you look at the number of acres we're talking about, we don't see any time in the near future where we will have solved all the munitions problems in terms of digging everything up, and just not a prudent use of resources to go that far. With that, I'm getting pretty close to the end of my time. I did want to leave a few minutes for questions at the end, so I'll turn it back over to Gene.
Thank you, Jim. We appreciate the information and your input and your time. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left, and we've received 3 or 4 questions. So if you're ready, I'll throw a couple at you.
Okay.
And can you comment on the expected percent of budget cuts or the funding levels for FY14, and what is the protocol for establishing for funding priority?
Okay. As far as budget cuts, again, all of our funds come in as environmental restoration account dollars. We split that between the installation restoration program, standard hazard waste cleanup, and the MMRP program. The prioritization basically, again, we use MRSPP for the munitions sites, and we, again, look at more of a high-risk sites within the IRP. But we do have one pot of money we split between the two. As far as budget cuts go, I don't know what it's going to be for 14. We haven't seen those numbers yet. I can say for the 15 and out years, I've seen as high as 30% cut. And we are right now about a $300 million a year program. So that's a substantial cut to the program starting in 15. It doesn't necessarily stay at 30%, but those are the numbers I've seen. 14, I just don't know what that's looking like at this point.
Great, thank you. Another one. For the 37 large sites greater than 1,000 acres, have any completed the RAFS or proposed plan decision document phases? And if so, what is the strategy to clean up or manage these sites?
And I'm pretty sure the answer is no on that. We've started some investigations on some of these sites, but again, nowhere near getting to the proposed plan record of decision on the sites. And again, those are the ones, like I said, I believe we're going to have to chop them up and basically portion them out based on, again, the likelihood of exposure. If we have an area near a cantonment area that extends out, for 5,000 acres, I'm going to start with the cantonment area where I'm more likely to redevelop first before I go out to the back 40 at the other, side of the installation. We don't have anything close there at this point. We do have remedial investigations going on quite a few installations. We have focused a lot of our attention over the last few years in terms of supporting redevelopment of some of these areas. So a lot of cleanups being done targeted at reuse. So I can't say we don't really have these.
In regard to land use controls what other community notifications, like to hunters, hikers, et cetera, are being considered?
Again, like we have used hunter education. Again, I'm kind of having to go back to some of the BRAC efforts because, again, we haven't gotten to those final efforts. But we do use the, again, the three R's, as a teaching tool. And we have hunter education where some of these areas are opened up for hunters to make sure they understand, that recognize, report, and retreat, three R's, don't pick things up. Don't take home souvenirs. That same, type of education, again, is across the board, has been used with elementary schools. And again, it's not just the Active Sites program. It's pretty much all UXO-related efforts near installations. They've passed out coloring books to kids, that type of thing, to make sure that we don't have kids picking up things that they shouldn't be picking up. So, a lot of education from that standpoint has been occurring over the past few years, and those will be incorporated into final remedies at all these sites. And again, depending on the target population, those who are likely to come in contact with these areas.
Great, thank you. One last question. We got about a minute and a half or so. There still seems to be a disconnect on many installations between the environmental and master planning offices when citing MILCON projects. What is AEC doing to improve or influence the master planning and site approval process?
Yeah, one of the things we've been trying to do, again, we put out construction site clearance guidance in the past. We are, through working with IMCOM, Installation Management Command, at this point in terms of any new construction projects are planned, to start at more of a planning charrette process that similar to what they do with the range areas, so that you bring the right people to the table early enough in the process to identify that this is a an IRP site or MMRP site. Again, we're still trying to, even from the IRP's perspective, to make sure that the master plans do flag all these sites. We use an Army mapper these days. That's not fully fielded to the, out to the installation level. That's being worked as well. But we will have a land use control layer on there, and it will highlight areas that need to be looked at from an environmental perspective in terms of future construction. But the planning charrettes piece is something we're really trying to push these days to make sure that we do identify up front what they may run into. And again, the intent I have, and this is just planned, we don't have a building footprint grading plan, but we know that they will develop in this area because that's the growth area of an installation. We want to be able to come back with euro dollars to do the clearance, to do the cleanup, because we're basically saying, okay, we put a land use control in place to be protective. If you change the land use, that makes it no longer protective. We have to meet our CERCLA obligations. So we're trying to make the case that the money still has to be there. Now, whether it's euro dollars or some other pot of money, to me it doesn't matter as long as the Army does plan for it and budget for it, and that fund, those funds are available to take care of the problem before they construct.
Great. We appreciate your time, Mr. Daniel. If you're able to be around for the general question session later, we may have a couple more questions for you. So we appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The next speaker on the agenda is Mr. Jim Pastorek. He is going to give us a perspective from a technical advisor role. Jim is the president of UXO Pro Incorporated. He provides technical support to state regulators in the area of munitions and explosive concern, project planning, management, and quality control. He has participated on numerous professional committees, including ITRC, National Research Council, and the Geophysical Classification Advisory Group. And Jim has a number of years' experience at MMRP sites, and he's going to share his perspective with us today. Jim?
Thank you very much, John, and thanks to the Huntsville Corps of Engineers for inviting me to participate today. Now, let's see if I can change my own slides. And it doesn't look like I can. Oh, did you do that or did I do that?
I did that, but it'll come. Don't worry.
Okay, I'll keep trying. On this first slide, the purpose of it is to tell you a little bit about me so you can understand my background and help you better understand the perspective or my perspective and where I come from when I'm talking about munitions response projects. Like many of the people on the phone and others in the munitions response field, I started my ordnance work in the military, in my case, the Navy. I also maintain my certification as a certified manager of quality and organizational excellence in the American Society for Quality because of a lot of the work I do is involved with assessing the quality of a munitions response project. After the Navy, I started my munitions response career as a project manager for UXB and then at IT Corporation before starting my current company in 1999. Next slide, please. At my current company, here's a little bit about what I do here. UXO Pro serves as technical consultants to state regulators. The activities we perform are listed on this slide, but one of the important things to understand about my role is that we aren't regulators or decision makers. That responsibility lies with the person directly employed by the state. They're the regulator, they're the decision maker. UXO Pro serves as the regulator's technical consultant. And to sum up our primary mission, it is to ensure that the state regulator has the technical information they need to make informed decisions. Let's go to the next slide, please. So when I was invited to give this presentation from the state regulator's perspective, I had a bit of a problem because I'm not a state regulator. So we modified it, and I've explained my understanding of some concerns on munition response projects that are common to many of the states. In general, the regulators are focused on ensuring that the munitions response projects in their states achieve the project's goals. Typically, this is achieving adequate site characterization in the case of remedial investigation, or adequate munitions removal in the case of a removal action. I've also come to understand that munitions response work plan for the state regulator is the key to establishing that these project goals are achieved. And so a lot of the rest of my discussion is going to be focused on the munitions response work plan. Let's change slides again, please. According to the Army Corps and U.S. Army Guidance on Technical Project Planning and also the Army Guidance Document on Performing Remedial Investigations for Munitions Response, which I think, by the way, is an excellent document, state regulators are key stakeholders, and they are provided the opportunity to participate in the development of the work plan, including the critical components of developing the conceptual site model, data quality objectives, and the technical approach to the project. And I see that John introduced that there's going to be some seminars coming up on DQOs and other parts of the technical approach, which are probably going to be very valuable. State regulators don't tell the contractors how to do their work, and most of them don't even want to do that. That's not a part of what they do, but they can be very helpful to the project by looking ahead and helping to develop the data quality objectives because they, the state regulators, are one of the important users of the data that is going to come out of the project. Then once the work plan is finalized and hopefully accepted and concurred with by all parties, including the state regulators, the regulators then expect to see the work plan implemented in the field, or if it can't be for some reason to be formally changed and the changes documented to respond to unanticipated conditions or potential improvements in the process that are devised on the site. So that the work plan is really the focus for many state regulators of their involvement in the project during the development and then during the implementation. So you're going to see a lot of emphasis on the work plan in the remainder of my presentation. Let's go to the next slide, please. So now let's talk about what goes wrong on some projects. These are common things that go wrong on some projects. Note that these problems that I'm going to discuss on the next few slides are common and have happened on numerous projects over the years. I mention them here because they are common and recurring. So I'm just going to go through the list on the next few slides, and these are things that you may have seen on your projects, maybe some things you've already implemented on the project. I'm going to talk about specific examples of this phenomenon. But one thing I want to mention here is that there's a pretty good document out there about defining what requirements are and then how to organize them, manage them, and build a good project, munitions response project around them. And that is a document on munitions response quality control by the ITRC, Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council. And that document was developed by a team of people consisting of, various Corps of Engineers offices, experts from the Center of Expertise, Army, Navy, EPA, contractors, state regulators, all together got together and developed this document. I think the flaws of the document is that it's not very hard-hitting. The things in it are not very controversial because everyone had to agree with them. But that's also one of the strengths of the document in that nothing in it is something that's would be considered wild or crazy or not something that should be done because everybody sort of bought into this. So I recommend going to that document, going to the ITRC website, downloading that document, and going through it. It's not very long. Has a lot of good information, and if that document is followed and understood, a lot of the things that we're going to talk about in the rest of my presentation would not be coming up as problems on numerous projects. The next bullet is lacking or inadequate documentation of the three-phase quality inspection program, the TPI program we call it. It's commonly used on munitions response projects. It's a really good format for a quality control program. And most of you know it requires a preparatory initial and follow-on inspections. But the point I'm making here is most people understand that. Most people write the document, but then when you get into the field, or even worse, at the end of the project, the documentation isn't there to support that the TPI program was implemented. So think about that. Think about at the end of the project, what is left? The project demobilizes. All that's left is the records that will live on forever, and if those records are incomplete, then the quality of the project is able to be called into question. And that's something I think that project managers and all project team personnel in general should want to avoid. So that's one of the common projects we see. Another one is no access on the site to the project database. More and more in the home office, on the site, somebody that's on the road in the hotel room can access those files. And that's a very good thing. And typically when a plan is written nowadays, it'll say, well, we will upload data to the project database daily. It will be reviewed by this person daily. And that's great because it can be done because your location doesn't really matter. But then again, you get on a project and the site doesn't have access to the project database. They don't have the facilities. You're in a remote area. I recall one site, actually it was a couple, in remote Alaska where there was a satellite internet provider that just wasn't able to follow through on what they said they were going to do. And this site had a lot of database requirements, and the whole thing fell apart because they didn't have, for most of the project, access to the database at all. So the message here is right. Make sure you can achieve and use a project database as you want, as you envision it in the office, in the city where you're working, and make sure you can envision and actually realize that out on the project site itself. Sometimes that's more difficult to do because of remote location. The last bullet on this page is use of incorrect geophysical instruments. you know, somebody writes a work plan and they specify a specific handheld instrument to be used, and then 6 months later when the project starts, different ones are shipped out to the project site. Well, all of these things call in question the quality of the data that comes from those instruments, because we don't know, we as the observers, don't know if it was critical that a magnetometer be used, or if it was critical on a reason for it, and there's not approvals of that, then we have to question the impact of that on achieving the project goals. Let's go to the next slide, please. For the bullets on this page, incomplete surface removal and incomplete 6-inch, or that could be any depth. It could be, you know, shallow analog clearance, typically 6 inches or to 1 foot. Note that in the case of the first bullet where there were remnants left out in the field, there may be reasons that that was done. For example, in some cases, the contractor may be prohibited from removing military artifacts for historical reasons. This happens a lot. I've seen it in Alaska, where the remnants of targets have to be left on site. The managers of historical preservation will not allow them to be removed. There's a site in the Caribbean that has Army tanks on a very popular beach. Well, that very popular beach used to be a landing area and a target area, and the Army tanks were left there for historical reasons. They're historical remnants, and they tell people they're part of the site. They tell people what the site was used for, and they're useful for that purpose. But if this is the case, if things are left out, it should be documented that the objects were left in place for a specific reason. The second one about analog clearance, this has occurred on several projects where, you know, a quick magnetometer check of completed areas shows that the soil and vegetation hasn't been disturbed over anomalies, and you can't do a 6-inch removal or a 1-foot removal without disturbing the grass and soil. But please note that all of these things can have an explanation and by themselves may not necessarily keep the project from achieving the project goals. But many of these issues combined can add up to decrease confidence, and the regulator may become concerned with the cumulative effect of these things as they add up, if they happen on an individual project and they are not documented as a reason for why. Let's go to the next slide, please. On this bullet, required data not being recorded is a common example is we have seen that the work plan may require locations, specific locations for all of MEC found in the grid, and that be recorded. But then actually the project implements something else, and they record number of MEC total in each grid and not the specific location. The questions we ask are, I mean, is the exact location of each MEC required? Is that data needed? Or is the total number of MEC per grid adequate information for the future decision making that needs, or what was the reason why it wasn't implemented? This is something that we see happen common, and this draws in the question whether the adequate data has been collected for that part of the project. The second one, QC failures are noted, but they're not followed through. This is a common, and it seems to occur sometimes due to misunderstanding between the on-site personnel about who is responsible for follow-up on these type of things. And let me discuss briefly QC failures here. Most state regulators don't view documented and corrected QC deficiencies or failures that are found by the quality control program. They don't view them negatively because these things show that the QC program is working. The quality issue was discovered, it was corrected and properly followed through, and a change to a procedure or a change to an instrument or some change was made to prevent it from recurring. That is not a negative problem or an issue, and sometimes I feel on projects that these QC issues are are sort of considered a black mark, and that's not the case at all. For the third bullet, required form and checklist not being used, we see this all the time. Sometimes it's very innocent, like the manager who developed the work plan is not the same person who implements the work plan. This happens commonly. People come and go or they're reassigned. And the person who's now going to implement it uses different forms and checklists. And maybe they love those forms and checklists and they've used them in the past and they're very comfortable with them. But the question we ask is, if when the DQOs were developed, when the plan was written, if specific forms with that require specific data to be collected and specific checklists that require specific things to be checked, if they were considered important at the time, why are they not important now? And you know, why were they not used? And is the data that was collected adequate to support the project the outcome, the project goals, and the decisions that need to be made? It's only a problem if it's not documented as these as forms are being changed during the project. If it's documented and there's a reason and that change is approved, there is no problem with this. Work plans can be changed easily. Let's go to the next slide, please. Another very common problem about a important component of munitions response projects is blind seeding programs. We frequently see different and conflicting blind seeding programs because sections of the work plan were written by different people, and these differences were never recognized and reconciled prior to the project or during project startup. An example of this, and blind seeding is a perfect example of this, because it's covered in the work plan, the quality control plan, and the SOPs typically. And these all discuss blind seeding, and they may all be developed by different people. And if that's the case, there are probably going to be differences between those different sections. And we see this frequently. Someone needs to read, you have the entire picture, and reconcile those differences and come up with a blind seeding program, because it's critical to confidence in the project. The second one is people unable to use required equipment. An example is an excavation team. Typically, more and more, we see them using an EM61 sensor to check that the object causing the anomaly has been removed from the excavation. This is a great practice. They get an exact reading, but the field team needs to know how to properly use this complex sensor for it to be successful. The M61 reads multiple channels, and the operator must be instructed which readings they're going to pay attention to. Is it the sum of all four channels, or is it only one channel, or the sum of two specific channels? That's a very detailed geophysics issue that needs to be answered by a geophysicist. And if there's not a geophysicist associated with the excavation team, or if the excavation team has not been trained to do this, typically they're out there, we see they're collecting the wrong data. They're not looking at the right numbers. This happens frequently. The last one, site managers not familiar with work plan requirements. This is an obvious problem, and it sounds really harsh. It sounds like the site managers and project managers aren't doing their job, but that's not what I mean to imply here. Our munitions response projects are getting more and more complex over time, and the equipment is getting more and more complex, and it's not going to get any less complex with geophysical classification. It's very difficult for any one person to be expert in the geophysics, in the ordnance and munitions handling, in the demo, and then let's throw in soil sampling on top of that. It's very difficult to call one person the site manager or the project manager and have all of that at your fingertips and have in-depth knowledge of it to that lead person so they know what's going on with that facet of the project, even though they may not be technically expert in it. Let's go to the next slide, please. I'm going to talk a little bit now about the cumulative effect of these issues, and that is the importance of confidence. I mentioned earlier that any of the specific problems I've talked about in the general list I've showed you may or may not prevent the project from meeting its goals. That determination is site-specific and varies from project to project, and it's quite a detailed analysis if these issues come up at the end. but numerous technical deficiencies. And let me define technical deficiencies for our purposes here. I'll define it as failure to implement a requirement of the work plan. That is a technical deficiency for what I'm talking about here. Numerous technical deficiencies occurring on a project have the effect of degrading everyone's confidence that the project has collected the data of sufficient quality to achieve the overall project goals. Maintaining project quality is under the control of, as I see it, two organizations, the Army Corps and the contractor. The state regulator is an observer of the process. This photo shows a work plan being used to elevate and aim a light box projector on a project site, and it's just sort of a joke. They actually did use it for that, and this was a pretty good project. They used it for more than that, but the point is the work plan has many uses. Its main one is to guide the project and tell the field people, the field managers, what data needs to be collected to have a successful project. Let's go to the next slide, please. Some more contractor confidence builders that can be implemented. So we talked about some common confidence destroyers. Now it's going to talk about some ways to build confidence. We frequently see these on projects also. I didn't want to be overly negative in my previous slides and just talk about deficiencies, although that is where I spend a lot of my time, dealing with the negative. Everything from here on out is personal opinion. Just want to let you know that there, because this does get very sort of opinionated here. In my opinion, the work plan is the key to a successful project. I recommend that contractors and the Corps support making it as simple as possible. Don't insert unneeded requirements because they sound good. They are only things that if they're not going to be implemented, write and say at once. Avoid repetition between different sections, like between the text and the SOPs and the QC plan. Say at once. That increases your chance of not having conflict. Managers should read the work plan, pick out the requirements, and then I think an important part of their job as far as maintaining quality is to check and or implement those requirements, make sure that they're checked and documented that they're implemented. And I think the best work plans do this for you. The best work plans have tables of requirements to say, here's what we do, here's the section of the work plan or the SOP that tells you how to do it. Here's the part, the section of the QC plan that tells you how to check it, and here's how often to check it, and here's how you check it. Those things built by the developers of work plans built into the work plan are a real benefit to the people that go out into the field. Let's go to the next slide, please.
Hey, Jim. Excuse me. This is John. You've got about 4 minutes left.
Okay, John. I think I can do it. Some more on contractor confidence builders. I mentioned earlier that properly identified, documented, and processed deficiencies are not a negative. I'm going to go further and say that they can be a positive confidence builder. Your projects are complex, and it is unlikely that any of them can be perfect from start to finish. What you need to do is identify and correct the imperfections when they happen before they affect your ability to achieve the project goals. Similarly, it is unlikely that a work plan will be perfect. They're getting increasingly complex because our equipment is. Use field change procedures that are written into every work plan to identify, respond, document changes, and get them properly approved by the chain of command of the project, including the Corps of Engineers, and that settles the issue. There's no question at the end of the project. Let's go to the next slide, please. I have two more slides on Corps of Engineers confidence builders. Regulators usually only visit a site briefly and rarely, and they're not there all the time. They rely on management and oversight of the Corps of Engineers for their confidence that there is QA site observation on the project. The fact that there's a Corps representative on site is a confidence builder, and that and the contractor documentation is really all that's left after the project demobilizes. Let's go to the next slide, please. But in my opinion, there's a flaw in this part of the USA ACE confidence building equation. EM 1110-1-4009 requires a class to guide the quality oversight. But I believe the Corps does this, and they do it diligently, but state regulators are rarely shown the class and don't get to see the results of the Corps quality oversight. We know they're there and on the job, and frequently, you know, that is a confidence builder, but I think we can increase the benefit of the Corps of Engineers confidence builder in this case if the Corps is more transparent and their QA efforts are shared with the state regulators. And frequently we don't see that being done. And we go to the next slide, and that is the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Jim. Hopefully you'll be able to stick around for the question and answer session at the end. We had one or two questions come up. The next presentation, you're going to hear from a couple of people who have been working on a very challenging project site with varied conditions that they've had to deal with over the years. That is Ms. Carol Charette. Carol is a project manager at our Corps of Engineers New England District. Carol has over 30 years of experience with the Corps in managing multidisciplined environmental PDTs in the FUDS program, and she is currently the New England District Project Manager for the Martha's Vineyard Project. And she is tag-teaming this presentation with Mr. Michael Warminski. Mr. Warminski has over 26 years of civil construction and environmental remediation experience with 12 years MMRP-specific experience, and he has been working on the Martha's Vineyard Project as well. Carol and Mike?
Thank you. Can you hear me? I just want to make sure I turn my mute button off.
We can hear you.
We got you.
Good. All right, I'll get started. Mike and I are going to present the unique challenges that we both face trying to conduct a remedial investigation at three project sites, all of them formerly used defense sites, on the Martha's Vineyard project. The overall project team consisted of personnel from New England District as well as the U.S. Army Engineering Support Center out of Huntsville. The New England District had overall project management responsibility. We also provided the dive coordinators and conducted all dive inspections throughout the entire project, as well as performed informal coordination with the local COMCOM, Conservation Commission, for all environmental requirements, as well as we did informal cultural resource coordination as well. We also provided the risk assessor as well as the chemistry support. Huntsville basically provided any kind of ordnance support to the project, the OE safety specialist throughout the field work, as well as any kind of geophysical support. Our contractor was UXB International. Michael Minsky was the project manager, and they had five subcontractors also working the project. AMEC International provided the environmental consulting. They developed most of the work plans. They also conducted some of the field work with regard to NC sampling. They are currently in the process of drafting three different independent RI reports. Aqua Survey provided the underwater EM survey. Battelle Institute, in concert with National Helicopters out of Canada, performed the airborne magnetometer survey, and NAIVA did the land-based EM survey. Parabolis, who's a veteran-owned small business, performed all underwater diving operations and geophysical work associated with that. I have to tell you, the coolest part of this whole project was a toss-up between the helicopter airborne survey as well as the dive team. They were both points of interest for any of the locals watching anything that was happening on Martha's Vineyard at the time. So as I stated, these are three formally used defense sites. They're all located on Martha's Vineyard. They were all funded and executed simultaneously, and they were all former Navy training ranges. On two of the sites, Cape Pogue, Little Neck Bomb Target site, as well as the Moving Target Machine Gun Range at South Beach, both had a time-critical removal action performed on those in 2009 prior to us conducting the remedial investigation. And both of those, at Cape Pogue, Either Mark 23s were being either eroded out of the embankments, the dunes, or out of the along the beach line where the water at the mean low tide area. And at South Beach, beachgoers were actually finding them as they were bathing in the waters offshore, bringing them ashore. And the patrol was at Martha's Vineyard was basically disposing of these things. So we received word of that, and in order to minimize exposure, we did a time-critical removal action at both sites in 2009. And then we followed up with remedial investigations at all three sites. We learned that at Chisbury Ray Pond, they have a particular area that they open up the barrier beach, particularly to lower the elevation of the pond, and as they do that, the currents are exposing some ordnance coming out of the dunes during that time frame by the current. So that's what prompted a remedial investigation at all three of these sites. Each of these sites includes four types of environments. They're all environmentally sensitive. They either include public or private beach areas. They all include upland areas. They some of them have inland water areas, ponds, and they all have surf zones. This next slide shows all of a picture of Martha's Vineyard. Just to orient you, up in the upper right-hand corner, this is Cape Pogue. The lower part of the screen, this is the South Beach Project. And to the extreme left, this is the Chisbury Great Pond Project. I'm going to go to the next slide temporarily to talk about Cape Pogue. Cape Pogue is located on Chappaquiddick. It is owned by the trustees of the reservation. This is the flood boundary for the Little Neck Project site. However, when we did our investigation, we extended the boundary all the way up to the north because there were reports of bombs actually landing on people's homes and going through their roof during, you know, World War II during the practicing. This is Shearpin Pond. This is Drunkard's Cove. During the time critical removal action, we literally went from Drunkard's Cove all along the entire shoreline, the interior of Shearpin Pond, and about 1,000 feet north on the interior of the bay. The remedial investigation continued and actually covered the entire area, both inside the entire bay area as well as the oceanfront area. At Cape Pogue, we were mostly finding Mark 23s and Mark 5s. So I'll go back to the previous slide and talk about South Beach. This is South Beach proper, what we call left fork to right fork. The next section is Norton Point, which you can actually drive a vehicle onto it to go to the beach. And then Catawba Bay is in this area here, basically from Norton Point all the way to where you get to the other side, which is called Wastley Point. This entire area is called Wastley Point. During storms, the Catawba Bay is opened up by hurricane or some forceful storm, and there's an opening or a cut in here where the water just basically flows freely through. Tide goes in, and then it comes back out. At South Beach, here's where we did the time-critical removal action, from left fork to right fork. That was where we went out anywhere from 0 to 100 feet offshore. The remedial investigation, we extended it from South Beach all the way around the point to Wastley Point. Now, and we'll see later on down in later slides or whatever what happened with Wastley Point as to whether or not we could actually conduct all our ocean transects on this side. At Chisbury Great Pond, this is the brackish inland water pond, just for anybody's edification. President Obama rents a house somewhere up this inlet each summer. So, curiously, he was there during the time that we were doing our remedial investigation a couple of years ago. So, this is the barrier beach, which, again, the Riparian Owners Association various times throughout the year will open the barrier beach so that they can drain the pond down to its healthy levels. They want to try and maintain the health of the pond because they have oyster bays in there. So when they open up this barrier beach, the current is phenomenal. They actually have to post someone there so that nobody is, none of the children are trying to ride the current out into the ocean. Otherwise, if you're caught in that, and they did have someone caught in that one year where it actually drove them out to the ocean about 3 miles offshore because the current was so strong. During the time that this cut is open, a lot of ordnance is being exposed because it's being drawn out of the pond or eroded from the dunes. So that's what caused this to become a project. As we said, we have varying terrain and a very dynamic surf zone. It is extremely high energy. It's constantly changing. It changes on a daily or hourly basis. We have encountered both ferrous and non-ferrous items. As I said, at Cape Hogue, there was Mark 23s and Mark 5s. And the other challenge that we've had is that we've encountered a lot of hot rock. So we had to discern basically the difference between what was a hot rock and what was actually a true anomaly by intrusive investigation and digging on items to identify them. We've also had numerous threatened and endangered species that we had to work around, particularly birds on the nesting on any of the beaches, mostly the piping plover and the leased tern. And I already discussed that this area here was the flood boundary initially that's outlined. And again, we ended up extending the investigation way north all the way to the northern part of Cape Hogue or whatever because of reports of Mark 23s being shown up there. The right of entry process was also very challenging. Cape Hogue wasn't too bad. We had basically the trustees of the reservation own most of the property. There's about 6 residents that live to the north. So that was not too difficult to acquire those rights of entry. South Beach, there was about 10 to 15 residents as well as agencies that we had to acquire rights of entry from. The most challenging was Tisbury Gray Pond. There was over 100 rights of entry that we had to get on the barrier beach itself. And the reason there was over 100 is because each part of the barrier beach was owned individually, and these parcels were like maybe 20 feet, 25 feet wide by 50 or 100 feet in depth, depending on how wide the barrier beach was at that time. And they were all privately owned. So the Kwansu Beach Association, who represented all these property owners, was reluctant to sign on behalf of them, granting the government access to the entire barrier beach. So we had to go back and get individual rights of entry from each property owner. Otherwise, if we had not been able to do that, we would not have been able to put the dive trailer on the barrier beach and traverse the entire beach in order to be able to do all the transects we had planned for in front of Tisbury Gray Pond. So fortunately, we were successful in doing that. It was a pretty tremendous effort. But we were able to acquire all but 2 rights of entry on the barrier beach. The interesting part of that was we started out where we had numerous phone calls to people. We tried to contact them initially via phone, and then we would follow up with a mailing, sending them the actual right of entry. We put public notices in the paper. And we also had a tracking spreadsheet that we created along with a map that corresponded to it so that as we were acquiring rights of entry, we would color code the map so that we knew what portions or where on land physically we had access and where we didn't have access. And it proved to be rather fruitful because then we knew exactly how we could prioritize and which rights of entry we definitely had to go after in order to be able to get to do the work that we wanted to do in the area where we needed. So it proved to be rather successful. The last item here, very, very involved stakeholders. MassDEP has been involved in the process throughout, as well as the key major property owners. We've developed excellent rapport and teamwork and great relationships with the town of Edgartown, the trustees of the reservation, the Mass Department of Conservation and Recreation, as well as the town beach manager. So we've done this through making sure that they felt that they were actively involved in the project. They actually had a say in the project. We've held numerous CPP meetings during the work plan development. We're in the process of holding additional CPP meetings between the draft RI and the final RI. So it turns out that it was an excellent example of cooperation and overall teamwork and good communication between all players. The next slide is a picture of a diver from Barrabolas actually entering into the water at South Beach into the surf zone. The divers have compared the experience of going into this high dynamic environment as being in a washing machine. Again, they had to go from mean low tide from zero out to 600 feet perpendicular to the beach. So it definitely was a challenging experience. At Tisbury Great Pond, I already said that the cut, every time they lower the elevation of the water, you know, due to the cut or whatever, it exposes ordnance. And again, they do that several times a year. It's not necessarily specifically timed to be certain parts of the year. It just depends on when the pond they feel needs to be lowered. The last bullet on this slide is the summer tourism season. Obviously, Martha's Vineyard is high tourism, anywhere from beginning mostly mid-June to Labor Day. So we had to coordinate our work around that tourism. South Beach itself, where we were working, had anywhere from 10 to 15,000 visitors per day. Tisbury Great Pond, again, is a recreation area. It's privately owned, so you know, the private beaches or whatever, I mean, people didn't want us working during the peak season when they wanted to go out and enjoy their beach. So, and again, Cape Hogue was used for fishing, kayaking, and boating. So, again, you know, we had to try and work around all these requirements and not try to disturb, you know, any of their recreation area. The next slide shows exactly how dynamic the beach environment is. This shows beach erosion. The top slide is a 2009 aerial photo as to the area that we were going to investigate, showing, you know, where the beach is located. If you look at the bottom slide, the beach literally just vanished. I mean, there was like 600 feet of beach that just went away. The other thing is, this is the Catawba Cut over here, where it was in 2011, and in 2009, it was located in this area. Previously, I had shown you on the other map that we went from South Beach all the way to the point of Wasteley Point. By the time we actually got to this area, in order to be able to do our transects, we could only go up to the cut as it continued to move further eastward. So we went up to the cut, and then we could not do the transects along this entire area that were planned because the beach was gone. There was no way to access it, and the trailer couldn't even get onto the beach. So we ended up doing a few of the transects in this extreme around the point, and then we could not collect the data from approximately this entire area here. The other thing I need to explain as well is the initial project was South Beach, and it was South Beach proper, which we called between Left Fork and Right Fork. It did not extend all the way to Wasteley Point, as the diagram now shows initially. We extended it all the way out to Wasteley Point because during a storm event, we had two 100-pound bombs approximately 1 year apart, both in March, that appeared just miraculously after a storm event right up sitting on the beach. So in order to address that, we extended the flood boundary of South Beach itself all the way to include Wasteley Point. With that, I guess, Mike, you need to take over.
Okay. Thank you, Carol. As Carol presented, this was a very complex project with a lot of moving parts. We developed a comprehensive approach using wide area technology, wide area assessments through technology demonstrations. We actually developed some transport study and hydrodynamic modeling to ensure that we had the areas covered properly. And then the RI field activities were traditionally what would be used to delineate nature and extent. However, because of the varying land areas, ocean and inland water areas, we had to use a multitude of sensors and approaches to be able to accomplish this. For the land-based, we used both EM and analog sensors. Underwater, inland water area was just EM sensors, and then for the ocean, areas, it was just handheld analog sensors. For all areas, we did supplement it with airborne magnetometry. Some of the areas were inaccessible either because they were wetlands, shallow water bodies, very shallow water bodies, but you couldn't walk or get a boat in, and also some areas where the no rights of entry were obtained, we were able to fly those areas without trespassing. The wide area assessment technology overview, this is a very good example of leveraging government funding. This project was funded separately through Carroll's involvement. They ended up using Martha's Vineyard as a demonstration site. And through the wide area assessment technology, it was an underwater survey technology that was being demonstrated. It was positioned just off South Beach. So essentially, the project received free data, for the most part, from the ESPCP program. But the project did contribute the intrusive investigation of any of the anomalies that were picked up in this technology demonstration. Fortunately for the project, this was one of the first items performed, and it leads to some of the lessons learned. The first item that we had here was in the offshore waters, there were very few munitions debris found. There were no mech items found. What we had here, which shows up, is a large number of no finds. In other words, when they went out to survey it, there was an anomaly that was picked. When they went back to dive on it, the anomaly was gone. We attributed this to the environment and objects moving through the survey area. As a result of that, what we came up with, and earlier, I believe Jim had mentioned field changes to the work plan. This resulted in the field change to the work plan to address the dynamic conditions. The only MD items we were found were very close to the beach, which helped to focus the remedial investigation near shore. There were no mech items found. There were no MD items found in deeper water. There was a large number of no finds. Initially, the ocean surf zone area was to be analog recon transects followed by intrusive investigation on grids based on the analog recon transect data. Because of what we saw here, we changed the analog transects to a mag and dig, because if there was an anomaly there, there was a good chance it wasn't going to be there when you came back at a future date to reacquire it. So using all of this data, we amended the work plan and changed the technical approach. Also tied to this was a transport study. Carolyn mentioned the ticker grids that were cleared at South Beach. What we had written into the work plan was we would go to previously cleared ticker grids, set up a known grid, do a baseline survey at the start of this project, and then survey it after storm events to see if we were getting any anomaly density changes. Lo and behold, the baseline study alone in previously cleared grids showed a large number of anomalies that had migrated in since the ticker, which was roughly a year earlier. After a storm event, we went back out and resurveyed, and the anomalies had increased tremendously in both of the grids after the storm event. So again, this drives the dynamic nature and again supporting the change to MAG-DIG for the ocean transects. Carol also mentioned the fact that there was a cuts made, essentially hydraulically connecting Tisbury Great Pond to the ocean. The Barrier Beach and the dune area were surrounding a former target area, which was used in the training exercises back in the 40s. Whenever they made the cuts, they noticed munitions debris and occasionally mech items washing out of the cut. Carol also mentioned the strong flow measurements. What we wanted to make sure was our ocean transect strategy would cover or bound any of the potential migration paths if something did wash out of the beach. We retained Woods Hole Group to do a hydrodynamic study. They actually field measured currents and did some empirical modeling to determine how far items would be transported through the cut. Results of the cut indicate with the tidal flushing you get movement both into and out of the pond, but looking at their data and the velocities, the velocity required to carry the mech items of concern here indicate that they'd be carried no more than about 400 feet out into the ocean surf zone, and through consultation with Woods Hole Institute as well, the predominant movement of something in the surf zone is west to east and not out to sea because of an offshore sandbar. So with our transects to 600 feet, we did in fact bound the potential migration of anything coming out of the cut. And what does this data tell us? From the grid surveys, the density post, you know, baseline and post dives, this was very dynamic. From the hydrodynamic study, we extended the ocean transects to 600 feet. And as I mentioned earlier, we did change all of the ocean transects to mag and dig. Moving on to the RF field work, again, this was nature and extent. A geophysical investigation followed by intrusive investigation of selected anomalies and MC sampling. We used a combination of geophysics, the recon transects on land, upland areas, because of the brush and some of the threatened and endangered plant species, were done with analog to minimize clearing requirements. The recon transects on the beach, where no clearing was required, was EM only. And then a combination of the results there, we performed surveys on geophysical grids for intrusive investigations, both on land and on the beach. We continued the transport study to gain additional insight as to the movement. And then we used the wide area assessment transport study data, as I mentioned earlier, to help focus and actually supplement the RI efforts. The MC characterization.
Mike, excuse me, this is John. Yeah, you've got 5 minutes.
Okay. MC characterization. With collecting soils and soil samples, groundwater samples, and sediment samples from the areas of the highest MD or MEC concentrations. I mentioned we did use multiple technologies. We used all metal, analog, and EM for the recon transects I mentioned. The reason for the all metal was the zinc in the in some of the practice bombs. And then the inland water transects were EM, and the grids were EM, and the field. The ocean was changed to be mag and dig. And we did overlay this with the airborne magnetometry. I can go through these real quick just to give those who may not be familiar with what they look like, EM and analog. Interesting on the underwater sensor, because of the shoaling and the relatively shallow waters, we could not get a large boat in. So we actually developed, with Aqua Survey, a cart which rolled along the sandy bottom, which would not dig up the oyster and clam beds, but still provide near bottom contact to maintain quality data. You saw the divers. They had developed a waterproof housing for the Schoenstatt to be able to use that offshore in the ocean. And then the air mag, which was the Patel sensors, was flown over the entire site. We did have to comply with all the environmental requirements. As Carolyn mentioned, we did have technical monitors, marine archaeologists, cultural resources staff involved with the project. From the Environmental Protection Plan, we developed a little field guide which everybody was trained on and used in the field to help identify as they went along. And on the technology considerations, I pretty much touched on these already. There was no one sensor or approach that was able to do the entire project. It was a combination of sensors and approaches with overlaying and combining the data to get to the end point. As Carol mentioned, all of the scheduling was geared around both nesting seasons and the tourist season, so we got to work there in some of the ugliest parts of the year when nobody else wanted to be there. We can go through these real quick as far as the summary. Carol mentioned the stakeholders involved early and often. Never underestimate the ROE effort. It seems like the FUD sites like this are all now resorts with a lot of very wealthy people who don't like to have their properties dug up or investigated. The surf zone is unforgiving, not only from changing conditions, but also worker safety. And the project management was also dynamic. We had weekly project calls with our client, the project team, both the Corps and the contractors, and also the regulators. And as I mentioned earlier, the work plan was a living document, and the field changes were made as we went. I think we're up to revision 3 right now to address the changing conditions. Diving is difficult at best. UXO diving is much tougher. All work here was done with jack stays and surface-supplied air to the divers on tethers. One of the considerations here is site logistics. Moving the dive team down the beach to work in the surf zone could be half of a day for the crew, so that's got to be figured in. And the dive work is very weather-dependent. A blow can come up here. You saw the map earlier. Essentially, the southern exposure was very, very dynamic. The eastern exposure around Cape Cove was very tame. So it wasn't only the site, but which sub-site you were working on that helped with the weather. As I like to say, the only thing predictable with the weather is unpredictability. It can and does change often. What has to be factored in is the downtime associated with weather and logistics. We ran anywhere from 10% downtime at Cape Pogue, which was, like I said, relatively tame, to 65% downtime at Tisbury Great Pond, which was very shallow water due to the shoaling from the sand washing out of the cuts and the exposure. Sensor selection is critical, and that was based on terrain, geology, and the munitions of concern. We used the analogs in the upland areas to minimize the amount of clearing that was required. We used the DGM for the transects on the beach where there was no vegetation, and we used all metals for the land-based recon transects because of the zinc practice bombs that were there. Natural minerals also impacted the surveys. We had a layer of magnetite on the beach, which we discovered after a storm when it took the top of the beach off. We did some ground truthing test pits with the magnetite, which allowed the geophysicists to better discriminate anomalies to pick in the dune areas from the EM surveys. One last note here. For those of you who have not had the opportunity to work with Bob Davis, he taught me an awful lot on this project. He unfortunately passed away midway through, and his tireless work here is what made this possible with the Environmental Compliance Act. And that's the presentation.
Thank you, Michael, Carol. At this point, we don't have time for questions for you guys. We got a couple in, so if you will stick around for the till. Thank you.
This is Jean Ballant, just reminding everybody we will be on intermission for the next 15 minutes. We will return at 2:45 p.m. Eastern. And while we were on intermission, the Adobe Connect room will remain open, the telephone lines will remain open, and the online streaming will remain turned on. You just won't hear any audio over the next 15 minutes because we simply won't be talking about anything over the break. But you can hang up and dial back in. You may leave the Adobe Connect room and come back in, or you can simply sit and leave everything as is. And again, we'll resume promptly at 2:45 p.m. Eastern. Thank you.
All right, Jean, are you there?
Hi.
Ready.
Okay, excellent. So, Kevin, are you on the phone there?
I am, yes.
Okay, excellent. John, if you're ready, feel free to introduce Kevin.
All right, thank you, Jean. Everybody, we've got two presentations left and then our question session. Thank you for coming back. Our next presenter is Mr. Kevin Kingdon, who is with Black Tusk Geophysics. He has over 10 years' experience working with geophysical sensor data, and he is a research geophysicist, where he primarily concentrates on improving methods for detection and classification of UXO. Kevin, take it away.
Okay, thanks very much, John, and thanks as well to the Corps for having me participate in this session. It's been really interesting. So in my presentation, I'm going to give a bit of an overview of Black Tusk Geophysics involvement at one of the ESTCP live sites from 2012, and that's Spencer Range from Tennessee. And the main focus of my talk is really going to be to give an overview of classification advancements that have occurred and the need for the development of some of these purpose-built advanced EMI sensors to collect the classification quality data. And then I'm going to sort of focus towards the end on how these sensors are now being extended somewhat to operate and perform classification when they're acquiring data in a dynamic mode. So just a bit of a history of the ESTCP LiveSite program. It was really designed to sort of gain some momentum for classification methods and to give experience to people new to the field and just to demonstrate that the success we can have and the cost savings that that are potential if we're successful with applying classification. So our involvement, we sort of started out near the beginning of the program in 2008 at Camp Seibert, Alabama. And ESTCP wisely chose a relatively simple classification problem to start with. There was a single large target, I believe it was 4.2-inch mortars, and that was it. It was a single large target emits sort of clutter and debris. So a relatively easy classification problem, but a very good starting point. So there was quite a bit of success with the ability to detect those targets there. And as the years have gone by, the sites have gotten sort of progressively more challenging. In terms of, you see in 2009 at San Luis Obispo, the target classes were increased, so there was more types of UXO present on the site. And you can see there's a bit more rolling hills, whereas Camp Seibert was essentially a flat, open area. It was also, with the development of sort of processing techniques, there's also innovations in the hardware that's gone on as part of this live site program. So at San Luis Obispo, that was the first deployment of the metal mapper there. And you see, moving on and into 2010, there was a site at Camp Butner, and from a classification viewpoint, there was a bit of a challenge there, in that a large amount of the clutter that was present on this site was similar in size and shape to the 37 millimeter projectile, which was one of the targets of interest. So, it becomes a little bit challenging from a classification viewpoint to be able to identify the 37s and sort of and reduce the amount of clutter that's similar size and shape. In 2011, we had a couple of different sites we participated in, which were really interesting in the sense that the data quality that was obtained at the two different sites was quite a bit different. Pole Mountain was still sort of, it's the benchmark for the best quality classification data I've really seen and seen people work with. And it's just, there was just a very low noise environment and just really excellent data quality. And I'll show some examples of that later on. And sort of on the flip side of that, there was the Camp Beale data set, which there's been some talk about in the previous sessions here talking about how magnetic soils can affect the data quality. And I'll show an example of what happened there. And it really, the data quality was much more challenging from Camp Beale as a result of some of these magnetic soil effects. And really what that led us to appreciate and understand is that the classification strategy we want to implement really is going to need to depend on the level of difficulty of the site, which is specifically related to the data quality that can be obtained. But for this talk, primarily I'm going to focus on Spencer Range results from 2012. And it was interesting because there were multiple sensors deployed, so it gave us a wide variety of these advanced EMI sensors to compare and see how the results played out between the different sensors. But also they were deployed in both the typical queued mode, where they're just placed over a target pick from a detection survey and sort of stacked high quality data is obtained. And there was also detection maps created with the dynamic data, so just acquiring these sensors, pushing them back and forth in lines, much like you would with an EM61, which then allowed us to compare the classification applied to just this dynamic data, which has potential large savings in time and cost if we can cut down the number of queued anomalies that we need to look at. So the standard processing flow for UXO detection and classification, just as an overview, the first thing we want to do is we want to acquire some data over an unknown target. Secondly, we want to extract some features from that data that tell us something about that unknown target. And finally, we want to take those features and form a feature vector, which we can use as input to a classification algorithm, with our end product being sort of a prioritized dig list with items most likely to be UXO at the top of that list, all the way down to the items most likely to be clutter at the bottom of that list. So the idea of what we're going to extract in terms of features from the data, what we use most often is something called the target polarizabilities. And this is a bit of a key slide, because for us what it comes down to is these target polarizabilities are intrinsic parameters. And so that is, they tell us something about the target that generated them. So for an axisymmetric target, which is typically like you would see for a UXO, with axisymmetry, I mean you have the long axis of symmetry with that blue arrow and two approximately equal axes of symmetry in the other directions there in the red and green. And so for the axisymmetric target, our polarizabilities typically look as shown here, where we can see we have a large L1 polarizability in blue shown there, and then we also have two equal polarizabilities in red and green shown on the bottom. Whereas if we have targets with no axial symmetry, you can see there's a piece of frag shown here. What we wind up with is sort of three distinct polarizabilities. And so we can use these polarizabilities to give us some indication of the likelihood of UXO or non-UXO. And so that's a key point in what we're going to be using for our classification. So just to give a summary of the advanced EMI sensors and the need for them and what the advantages of some of these new sensors. The Geonyx EM61, it's long been the workhorse of the UXO community for geophysical mapping of a site. But over the past few years, there's been advancements made in terms of building specific classification design sensors. And they give us some advantages over the EM61. So first of all, you can see that in the EM61, we have just a single transmit loop with, you can see there, it's a 1 meter by half a meter loop on the left there. Whereas if we look at the metal mapper, we've got three orthogonal transmitters shown as the red squares there. So we've got multiple transmitters which are exciting the target from multiple angles, and there's seven different receiver cubes shown in black, you can see there in the middle. And so what that does is it gives us a multiple looks at the target, which allows us to get a better understanding of the shape of the target, first of all. And because we have these multiple transmitters and receivers, as opposed to just one footprint that's a meter by a half meter in the EM61, we're actually better able to position the localization of the target as well, so better positioning. And finally, these sensors are designed to sample the decay rate much better. You can see on the bottom there for the EM61, we've got four time channels at about going out to about 1.2 milliseconds, where conversely with the metal mapper, we're going out much later in time, almost to eight milliseconds, and we're sampling that decay rate much more at a much finer interval. So just more information is basically the result of what we're getting there. And sort of showing that based on a data set, how does that translate into our capabilities and our abilities to perform classification? This is an example from Camp Butner, one of the sites I showed you where we're trying to differentiate the 37s from some of the clutter. And you can see with the EM61, we've got a feature space there. And what I'm showing in the middle two sections of plots, let me see if I can get my green arrow on here to, Gene, I'm not actually able to move my green arrow. Ah, there we go. Excellent. Thank you. So in this is the feature space for the EM61 plot, and we've got the size on the horizontal axis and decay on the vertical axis. And typically for UXOs, we know that they're going to decay much slower than, say, a beer can or something that's very thin-walled. So we expect them to be slow decaying and relatively large in size. And the challenge you can see with the EM61 data is we have two different target classes, but they overlap. And more of a challenge is all these black dots are confirmed clutter, and you can see they're also just interspersed within the the cloud there. Whereas we, conversely, if we look at the TEMTADS data we've got here, you can see we get very well-defined clusters of specific targets, and they're very separable in this feature space. And the power of that really lends to the classification and differentiating clutter from scrap. And how do we quantify that? Well, on the far right here is what we call the ROC curves. And so what you can see in these ROC curves is basically you take your dig list and you start digging things up. So every time you go down and you find something that is a UXO, you move vertically up one. If you dig something and it turns out to be not a UXO, you're going to move horizontally. So your ideal dig list basically goes straight up. If you can imagine you're a map of the U.S., you're in Southern California, and you want to go to New York, but you want to stop by Seattle. You want to go straight up the coast. And then at that point, you're going to define your stop dig point, and then you're going to head east all the way over to New York. And not everything there from Seattle to New York would be your clutter items that you've rejected. And so you can see just in terms of the performance in those rock curves that there's a much better performance obtained via the TEMTADS, where we get this vertical shape of the rock curve and then defining our stop dig point with a bunch of clutter beyond it, whereas the EM61 virtually has to dig everything to get all the TOI on the site. So that motivates some of the reasons for these advanced sensors. So with these advanced sensors, the challenge is dealing with, like I say, they're a very data-rich sensor in terms of multiple look angles and transmitter and receiver combinations, but it's a bit of a challenge for an analyst to be able to identify and QC the data. So you need software dedicated to classification. And there's a few different options out there for software packages. Certainly, the industry standard is the UX Analyze package from Geosoft, which many groups have used. We've developed our own software called UXO Lab, which is kind of a purpose-built classification set of tools, and we've done that essentially to be able to incorporate some of our research results from the CERTIP and ESTCP projects into the production processing of data that we're doing. So I'm going to show results from groups using both those software packages, and there's certainly probably other software out there that's being used, but a lot of people are getting very similar results with both of these packages. So specifically the UXO classification at Spencer Range, before we get into it to a little more detail here, we can see the site location, and there was a few different areas. There was a wooded area, an open field area where some of these vehicular sensors went, and then there was a dynamic area where there was overlap in green there. Multiple sensors were deployed there. So I'm going to look at our goals for Spencer Range, where really we wanted to look at a full range of instruments and classification performance from all of them and compare results that were obtainable. Secondly, we really wanted to look at the dynamic data in terms of what we can obtain with dynamic data and how far the classification can go just using the dynamic data on its own without the queued data. So in terms of the targets that are present at the site, we had everything from large targets like a 155 millimeter down to a small ISO. And the ISO, that's actually stands for an industry standard object. And if it looks like just a section of pipe that you would pick up at Home Depot, that's exactly what it is. You heard Jim in his talk mention the importance of blind seeding a site. And that's especially important when we're looking at classification, where we're trying to convince people that it's safe to leave objects in the ground. So if we can seed this site with items that are, you know, of the same size as the smallest target of interest on the site, and we can guarantee them that we have a procedure in a place that is able to get all of these targets with no problems, then there's more confidence that the classification process is something that they're willing to buy into. And another advantage of having this small ISO is that, you know, you literally can go into a Home Depot and pull it off the shelf. So no matter where your site is, you have access to these surrogate targets. And it's an axisymmetric target similar to our UXOs. So it'll give us those same characteristic polarizabilities we saw earlier. And a bit of later, I'm going to have some slides that show the value of having this repeatable target at multiple sites allows us to use it as a bit of a proxy for some of the level of difficulty of the site by looking at those polarizabilities. So then looking at some of the things we don't want to dig up on the site, we'd like to leave in the ground if possible. There's some typical things like cans and wires, springs, some small arms, munitions, 50 cal. On this site, there was a fair number of frag, and much like I mentioned earlier with the Butner site, some of our issues are that we have frag that actually looks to be somewhat axisymmetric and similar to some of our targets of interest. So the classification problem really becomes identifying items of frag that are similar to our targets, and we want to try and exclude as many of those as possible, but it's invariable that some of these frag items are going to be dug. They're just too similar from a classification viewpoint that we can't just omit all of them. So here's some results. These are rock curves, as I mentioned before, the whole idea of going up vertically and then turning right. And these, I should point out, these are rock curves that were generated by geophysicists from industry firms who do not have extensive classification experience. So it's pretty impressive results when you consider like the level of difficulty, and we'll look at that in the next slide, I think, in terms of how Spencer Range rated comparable to other sites. But if we look at the sort of these three rock curves, you can see that all of the TOI were identified before their stop dig point, which is indicated by the blue dot. The yellow dot is the point where the last target of interest was actually dug. So you can see they had a little bit of buffer in these two. This one was quite a bit closer, which is fine. But in all cases for these three, you can see that there's been a significant reduction in the number of digs required for these industry geophysicists. So a really promising result. And even some of these ones where a few items were missed, they started off pretty well. And one of these cases, the item that was missed, it was a very challenging target. And it was a small ISO that was intentionally seeded with a piece of frag that was very similar in shape. So you really need to have a good multi-object inversion working and a bit of experience to identify that as a multi-object scenario is warranted. But overall, very, very promising results. But the question is, how do we know the level of difficulty in terms of what type of classification we can perform? And this is, I'm going to come back to the small ISO that I had talked about earlier, and we'll look at some of the results. So the idea being that if these polarizabilities are intrinsic parameters and they tell us something about the target that generated them, we would expect the polarizabilities for a given target to not vary at the site. So in sort of the absence of noise or any other sources of data issues or problems, we would expect the polarizabilities to plot basically on top of each other. So you can see the pole mountain results. And what it's done here is every ISO that was seeded at the site is plotted on this same axis here. So you can see there's very little spread in these polarizabilities. They're very well recovered with both the primary and the secondary. So very high quality data, that's what we can expect. Conversely, I mentioned the other site from 2011, Camp Beale. You can see that for all the small ISOs on that site, there's considerably more spread, particularly in the secondary polarizabilities, these ones here in green and black. And that becomes more of a challenge from a classification standpoint because we know we don't have the same reliability in these polarizabilities that we would assume if we're looking at matching them with a reference library. So there's a couple points to make here, I guess. One is that when we see this variation on the ISO, we can use it as a bit of a proxy for the level of difficulty, and we certainly know that Camp Beale is going to be a much more difficult site for classification than Pole Mountain based on this. And of course it depends as well on other external factors like the targets present and how they are representative to the amount of scrap. But just from a purely data perspective, you can see that it's more of a challenge from Camp Beale. And then we look at Spencer Range, and we can see that, you know what, it falls somewhere in the middle in terms of it's not as bad as Camp Beale, but certainly not quite as good as Pole Mountain. And so just to show how those variations occur, I'm going to just show a slide showing some tech transfer that we had industry partners who came as part of our ESTCP involvement to our offices, and they processed data using our software for both Pole Mountain and Spencer Range. And you can see that as the Pole Mountain results generated just a fantastic looking rock curve, just virtually straight up, and then all the targets are identified. And in Spencer Range, you know, it's still an amazing reduction in the number of digs as they've done well, but you can see that you don't get that same vertical straight up nature of the target because it's a more challenging site. But there's still a huge reduction in digs obtainable and all the targets of interest were identified. So that was queued metal mapper data. And so now at Spencer Range, if we look at some of the other data that was present there for the other sensors, the TEMTADS 2x2 and the MPV are shown here. And in these cases, these data sets were actually processed by classification researchers rather than production contractors. And there's no sort of real reason that had to be the case, certainly based on the results that some of the the industry geophysicists have been obtaining, that there's no reason they couldn't be looking at some of this TEMTADS and MPV data as well in the future. One interesting thing to note again is that there was one missed target in all three groups with the MPV, and again it turned out to be identified when you look at the ground truth as just a very challenging target. It was a small ISO, and it was in a frag pit with five other items. So from a classification viewpoint, it was just, you know, it's good to see where the limitations lie as well, and that, you know, if three of the top experts couldn't get this target, then there's maybe you've reached a challenge that's pretty tough to get through. So looking at the queued interrogation issues, we've seen queued metal mapper data and queued data from the TEMTADS 2x2 and the MPV. And there are some issues with the sort of the standard classification approach now, where you send out an EM61 sensor, you pick targets, and then you send back your queued sensors to those locations. And the main issue is that we're inherently starting with the EM61 map, which has some known difficulties to it. There's the fact that we have that 1 meter by half a meter footprint of the sensor, so target responses will tend to get smeared. And I can show an example from Spencer Range here that sort of highlights that. What I'm showing is dynamic metal mapper data and EM61 metal mapper data for the same location. And what you can see is we ran the inversion on the metal mapper data, and it indicated, okay, there's three sources that are present for this target, and they match up actually pretty well with the observed data that I'm showing here. You can see there's three distinct responses. Whereas if we look at the EM61 data, the main anomaly is identified, but these other two, there's really very little evidence that there's separate distinct anomalies there. So that's one of the challenges when our starting point is the EM61. Certainly with targets in close proximity, and then the inaccuracy of those picks. So then the question comes, well, if we have these queued sensors, what about operating them in a dynamic mode? And I'm shown here, this is a picture of, it's called the Optima sensor. So this is designed, it's kind of, in this image, in this sort of stage of its development, it was almost like a metal mapper pulled behind the sensor with just a slightly different layout of receiver cubes. So the idea of combining the one-pass detection and classification, there are some definite advantages in that we would expect to have improved resolution, and near-surface clutters will be a lot more susceptible to showing up in the TEMTADS 2x2 and the metal mapper dynamic data, because those sensors are dragged along the surface. They're much closer to the surface, and they're much more sensitive to near-surface clutter than the EM61, which sits a bit higher. Another advantage is it's one less sensor to deploy to the field. Instead of sending an EM61 and the metal mapper, you just send the metal mapper and it collects the dynamic data. And finally, that if the data quality is sufficient for the dynamic metal mapper data, we can really cut down on the number of queued locations that the metal mapper actually has to go back to. There still may be some that just aren't of sufficient quality to perform classification, or there's some uncertainty in the inversion results and we have to go back for queued, but we really hope to reduce the number by quite a bit. But then there are challenges with that approach as well. And one question is, what's the production rate compared with the EM61 and the metal mapper? And we do have this increased sensitivity to near-surface clutter. And then it's just keeping in mind that, you know, what happens with our variations in terrain, because we're taking these sensors that are, you know, designed to be just placed statically over a target, and then we're going to start dragging them around the site. And are they robust enough to stand up to that? And then also the idea that this dynamic data we're collecting with the metal mapper, it's not going to be as high quality as our queued data, which sits over the target and averages over a longer time. So is the reduction of data quality still sufficient in the dynamic data to perform classification is our concern. And so if I just look at some of this data, we can see an example. You see right away that the main features on the left channel here, we've got EM61 data, dynamic metal mapper in the middle, and dynamic TEMTADS on the right. So you can see that the main features, the target picks shown in the white dots that are present in the EM61 data, also show up in the metal mapper and the TEMTADS. Whereas you can see some of these smaller items are not showing up in the EM61, but they are showing up in the metal mapper and the TEMTADS. And really it's just probably near surface small clutter that we can actually look at some of the later time channels in these advanced EMI sensors and rule them out. But I wouldn't necessarily say it's a problem that we're getting these extra targets showing up, because they're legitimate data. It's on your site, and you probably want to know about it. Okay, so now I'm just going to show some results from classification using the dynamic data. So here we're looking at, this is dynamic data only for TEMTADS 2x2 and the metal mapper. And you can see that here's the rock curves that were generated for those two results. So pretty good results from the TEMTADS 2x2. It goes up. It's not quite as good as our queued data, but again, our data quality isn't as good as our queued data, so we have to expect that there would be some trade-off in terms of performance. And then looking at the metal mapper, it goes up pretty nicely as well vertically. This section here, this black, those are all can't analyze anomalies. And in this next slide, I'll just show the reason why that occurred. You can see that it was just a data coverage issue, really. There was a number of items in the dynamic metal mapper which just were not surveyed. So there was just no data over those targets that are shown in green here. And as a result, we don't know anything about that data, so we had to classify everything as can't analyze and dig it. Another option we would have had would have been to look at the queued metal mapper data for all these targets where the metal mapper was sent back, and that certainly would have shifted this rock curve over here. But the analyst looking at this data was very insistent that they want to see only dynamic metal mapper data and all the limitations that come with that. So if we just, in sort of summarizing here, if we just want to look at a comparison of these different modes for Spencer Range, and we had to make some assumptions in terms of, you know, a number of targets and the cost for doing these different surveys, but if we look at the top here, I've got three different modes of operation. This first column here, DGM, that's really EM61. So if we'd send out just an EM61 and we pick over a threshold and dig everything, no metal mapper, no advanced EMI sensors, just the EM61 only, we've got 339 digs that we have to do. And so you can see there's a certain number of mech, a very small, tiny portion, which is typical of most UXO sites, I imagine, and then a lot of clutter that had to be dug. When I call this one-stage approach, this is really, I'm saying we take the EM61 and we replace it with, say, a dynamic metal mapper. So again, we're able to get all this mech, but we've reduced the number of clutter we have to dig by all the way down to 69. So 80% fewer excavations, and we're still getting all the mech. And this is one pass, I say one stage, it's maybe more appropriate to call it one pass dynamic metal mapper data. In the two-stage approach, this is where we send the EM61 out first, we get our target list, and then we actually send the queued metal mapper back to all those locations. And you can see what it does is it drives down the number of digs even further, down to 53, because remember, that queued metal mapper data is of higher quality, so we're probably going to be able to do better with classification. But we have the additional cost of sending that sensor out. So if we assign some numbers to these, we can see for the EM61, you've got your basic cost in green here of sending out the 61, but the bulk of your cost is digging non-UXO, non-targets of interest. The dynamic metal mapper case, we see it costs more to send out the sensor. It's just, you know, the metal mapper dynamic data, it's just a more complicated sensor. It's maybe more time consuming to collect. We assume, I think, 50% more. But you see you have a large reduction in number of digs. And finally, if you look at the two-stage approach, we've got the same cost of the EM61 sensors we had originally to send out and create the detection map. We have the additional cost associated with queued metal mapper data now. And then we have the smallest amount of digging done, but all total, it's actually slightly more expensive than doing just the dynamic metal mapper based on these sort of numbers we've used. And so just, I think that's it, just one more conclusion. So in conclusion, all of the advanced EMI sensors which were deployed at Spencer Range really generated excellent classification results. And certainly it's not just researchers and UXOs that are doing well. Production contractors are getting some real promising results with the queued metal mapper data. And we're very happy with some of the dynamic data classification capabilities that we were able to see at Spencer Range with reducing up to 80% of the clutter digs there. So those are good results. And just in closing, I want to acknowledge CertUp and ESTCP who funded a lot of the research that's gone into this talk, and they've been a great partner for us. And thanks, that's all I had.
Thank you, Kevin. Very good stuff. We did get a couple of questions for you. We'll hold those for the question and answer session, so I hope you stick around.
Sure.
On with the presentation, we're going to hear about land use control lessons learned at active Army installations from Ms. Maria Orris. Ms. Orris is a project manager with our Environmental and Munitions Design Center at Baltimore District. She has a number of years of experience as a PM for MMRP FUDS projects. And Maria, here you go.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I will be discussing the implementation of non-time critical removal actions for the interim MMRP land use controls at active Army installations. Just wanted to provide an overview. I'll be looking at or discussing the background and the overall purpose for the land use controls, and then discussing the execution as well as specifics related to land use controls and which ones were selected or recommended. And then just some lessons learned throughout the process of trying to get these implemented at each of the active installations. So just a little background. As many people are aware, the MMRP site inspections were conducted nationwide between 2003 and 2010. There were several MRSs based on whichever installation it was at, what the findings of the site inspections were. Some of the MRSs were recommended for further investigation into the remedial investigation stage and then obviously some of these were they contain potential explosive safety hazards, which is why they were likely recommended for further investigation. So the land use controls, this provided the basis for the land use controls, with the SIs being completed in 2010 and moving into the RI stage. There was the acknowledgement that it would be several years before a final remedy would be in place at each of the MRSs. So by adding the interim land use controls, this helped protect against human health and safety at the sites. So just the framework that the LUCs have been implemented on are the requirements that are listed on the slide, 40 CFR with CERCLA 300.415, and then the Defense Environmental Restoration Program, as well as the DOD ammunition and explosive safety standards. So the overall purpose, as I briefly explained, is to implement interim land use controls for all MRSs being evaluated under the active MMRP. And, you know, the importance is that these are interim land use controls until a final remedy has been established. And basically, they're designed to minimize potential exposure to explosive safety hazards or potential munitions constituents until that final remedy is implemented at each of the MRSs. It only focuses on preventing exposure to human health. That's the primary focus of these. So the environment is kind of not the primary focus for the implementation of these. It does not apply to transferred MRSs, so any property that's not owned by the DOD, and I'll get into some exceptions later on in the lesson learned as far as where leased properties come into play, but it's only on Army-owned property that we're implementing this, and they're also on post. There are several MRSs that I know go beyond on post, and I'll talk about that again in lessons learned. And this was a unilateral decision by the Army to implement with the acknowledgement, like I said, that the final remedy may not be in place until several years out. So the execution of the non-time critical removal action, basic sensitivity, complexity, cost, and comprehensiveness. So all these conditions supported the implementation for a non-time critical removal action. And with this implementation, basically there were several components to getting this executed. The initial was a kickoff meeting with Army only, so that included individuals from the Corps, AEC, the Army Environmental Command, and then the installations, to just try to discuss which MRSs we could actually apply this to. And again, with the lessons learned, I'll talk about how that was key in speaking with the installation and just making sure that we understood which MRSs this could actually be applied to. And then that was followed by a TPP meeting with the regulators and any other additional stakeholders once we knew which MRSs these could be applied and everyone had an understanding. We presented this to the regulators. And then following that TPP meeting, we had issued draft final and final ECAs with the public notice. So the ECA was drafted. It went through internal Army review and then went out to the stakeholders and then was finalized pending a public review. The ECA only had two alternatives. One was no action, and one was the land use controls. So as you can tell, pretty much every site, I think we only had one site where no action was recommended, because in between the time of executing the ECA, no further action from one of the MRSs was achieved, and it was decided that we didn't need to do alternative two. The ECA was followed by the action memorandum, and that basically served as the decision document and specifically identified which interim land use controls would be applied. And each of these were applied, you know, per MRS. And then that was followed by a land use control plan with a public meeting if requested. We didn't conduct a public meeting unless we put out an announcement, and we did not hold one unless based on the comments we had received that it was requested, I guess. So again, the interim land use controls, the basis for selection, once we had identified the MRSs, we used the site inspection, the final site inspection reports, or any other, the most recent report that we could find. Again, some installations or some MRSs had the RIs had begun, so we also built or took some of that information, so any current information, but the site inspection was the basis for the initial selection. And then each of the land use controls were based on the current land use and guidance from the installation. Again, this was dominantly a paper exercise. No field efforts were expended on this. So we had to rely on the installation to kind of give us the feedback, you know, based on the site conditions, what would be the most appropriate land use control to apply to each of the sites. The types of land use control that were looked at included institutional controls, which is the land use restrictions, notations, and master plans, your dig permits, and your public advisories. Engineering controls that were considered were signs, markers, fences and guards, and then any other measures such as annual inspections, environmental self-audits. Some of the installations already had, I guess, installation-wide institutional controls, but these were specific for the MRS. So that was basically the main difference in these, and making the notations in the master plan, was that it was specific to each of those MRSs. And I'm just going to continue on to lessons learned. If anyone has any questions, please. I guess we're holding those to the end. So moving on to the lesson learned, I guess in regards to the contract award, this contract was originally awarded for 52 installations. It was taken from a list in which, you know, each of the installations had MRSs that were recommended for additional investigations. And basically, as we went down the list of the initial list, it was reduced to 26 installations, because by the time we had our Army-only call, or we had actually spoken with the installation, many of the installations said that there was already some type of land use control in place specific to that MRS, or that post-SI investigations had recommended no further action, or overall, the installation just didn't think that, you know, the land use controls would be applicable to their specific sites. And I just have here recommend coordinating with the installation prior to any type of land use control implementation. They know best what the most up-to-date action is that's occurred, and even down the road, you know, what exactly might be the recommendation for the site. Regarding the contract, the period of performance was initially 1 year. We had the 52 installations sectioned off into four groups that were to be awarded every so many months, and then that would be 1 year from notice to proceed. But what we found out was during a lot of the review times of the documents, it was in excess of 45 days for some of the regulatory reviews. And I mean, even still, we have some that are greatly delayed. So you might want to consider it might take more than a year to implement, depending on your, I guess, relationship with the installation and the installation's relationship with the regulators. As far as how we constructed the ECA and the action memorandum and the land use control, for consistency, we try to maintain a template for each of the three documents so that it would they would all look similar across installation-wide, across each of the installations, and it would be easier for us to write them since we were basically writing three documents per installation. And again, they did provide consistency. Some of the requests that I've gotten along the way is after we've gone down the land use control, once we hit the land use control plan, I've had a few installations request a template for annual inspections or a self-audit. And basically, it's kind of up to the installation if they are already conducting annual inspections or other self-audits that they would just kind of add these particular land use assessment of the land use controls into their inspections. So we have not provided any kind of template. We've kind of left it up to the installations to come up with their own specific template for the inspections and the self-audits. And I realized that I had not advanced the slide, so I apologize for that. The regulatory involvement, like I said before, it was a unilateral decision by the Army to implement the interim removal action. We're seeking regulatory concurrence, not acceptance, and I think that is key. So I know I had said that we were, you know, as a courtesy, we're waiting on comments, but at the same time, no one's required to sign the action memorandum from the regulatory side. It's all installation specific. And what we're kind of running into with the delays is that we're basically electing to either, issue a statement to the regulatory community saying, hey, look, we've given X amount of days. If you don't have any more comment after this day, then we're going to progress on. And then we've also, in some incidences, with a comment, not addressed it and issued a letter stating that we weren't going to address that particular comment. Some of the feedback we've gotten back is that there's confusion between these interim LUCs versus the final LUCs because they may be similar. And in many occasions, the basis for some of the final LUCs may be the interim LUCs, or they may be incorporated into the final measures. So these are interim actions that will terminate once the final remedy has been decided at the site. Again, document review delays. I would just encourage you to identify what the adequate review times are and make sure everyone's aware and stick to the schedule as best as possible. And again, like I said before, the interim LUCs may be included within the final remedy. Installation involvement, we've had a few situations where, you know, there's higher profile sites or higher profile installations with that are very much in the public eye. And since these are interim controls, we've had some installations just say, look, we acknowledge this is a great idea, but at the same time we have other higher priority things going on right now, and we'll do our best to review the documents when we can. So it's been a challenge with some installations to you know, try to stick to the schedule and make sure that these documents are reviewed. And I mean, we're talking about documents that are, you know, 30 pages at most, depending on the number of installations that are within each of these. So we understand that it's not a priority, but at the same time, we've been working with them to get the reviews done. The installations do offer significant insight and knowledge regarding the application of the interim land use controls. They know, you know, accessibility and the specifics related. So they've been very helpful with actually deciding which land use controls get applied to which MRS. And then, you know, relative to the installation and getting the action memorandum signed, we have also had delays caused by staffing, specifically with the garrison commander's of the action memo. That's pretty much the only document, since it is that decision document, that we are requiring that the garrison commander sign. Regarding the preparation of the ECA, the non-time critical removal action requires that the ECA is written. It is in accordance with CERCLA, and it does allow for public comment periods. So we have 30-day comment periods that do occur before the ECA is finalized. Regarding pre-existing land use controls, some of the confusion that's come about is the installation-wide land use controls versus interim MMRP land use controls. And then also there's some overlap with IRP sites versus MMRP sites. Sometimes the MMRP site is located in the middle of the IRP site, but we're only applying the interim LUX just specifically to the MMRP MRS. So, and again, as far as the installation-wide goes, they're not specific to the MRS, and these interim LUX are designed to acknowledge the fact that, okay, you do have it installation-wide, but, you know, we just want to point out the fact that it is specific to this particular MRS. The next lesson learned is in regards to property, off-post Army lease property. We've had several situations where there's a lease agreement. So basically there's property that's been leased from an installation to a state agency, and we've actually had to involve some of the lawyers to kind of take a look at the lease agreement and see if we can apply the interim LUX to these. And it is on a case-by-case basis with the lease agreement and what specifics relative to the Army's responsibility are within that lease agreement and whether or not we can or cannot apply the interim LUX. Moving on to public perception and involvement. Again, like I said, there's some MRSs and some installations that do have that higher public awareness. So just want to be careful. A lot of the installations had expressed concern that, you know, by issuing the ECA, that it would basically provide the public would basically have some concern because we are implementing and just draw attention even more to the highly publicized sites. And that's not the intention of this. It's just to take precautions. So there was some concern over that. To date, no public comments have been received on the ECA. So we've put these out, certain announcements in the newspapers, and you can see that 18 of the 26 installations that we've held the public review for have not submitted any comments. And also to date, as far as the land use control plan, we have not had any separate public meetings been requested, though as a courtesy, the installations have asked for some of the installations to have discussions at the RAB meeting. So although a separate public meeting wasn't held, the RAB served as that public forum to make the announcement and let people know about the interim land use controls. With number nine, there were several questions from the installations regarding the funding and how these are going to be implemented. This action here is just to provide the basis, the framework to the installation and the guidance to the installation to implement these land use controls. We are not providing funding for implementing land use controls. So we're only performing the non-time critical removal action. And implementation is the installation's responsibility. And there are other means in which the installation can request DIRP funds for the implementation of the land use controls. And I think that's all my lessons learned as far as implementing these. So if anyone has any questions, I guess I'm open to those at this point.
All right. Thank you, Maria. In fact, we did get a couple questions. You may have answered this question a couple slides ago. Since the interim land use controls were focused on human health, why did the Army decide not to include the transferred MRSs? Because you would think that those would have greater exposure than a site on the installation.
So I guess by transferred, I guess it would mean like the least, the I'm going to assume that's the least properties. I think there was just, in speaking with the lawyers, there were some technicalities with the way the lease agreement was written. We were, we would have implemented the interim land use controls if the lease agreement had kept in there that we did have some ownership of the site, that we were still to maintain the site. But in instances where I think the lease agreement said that the new agency was required to kind of take over that area, that it became their responsibility for implementing. I hope that answers the question.
Great. Another one. If a regulator doesn't
any regulator, when we've issued the statement, there's been very few that have not been in agreement with things. And once we issued the letter, we haven't gotten any additional kickbacks or feedback from them. So I can't speak specifically because honestly, we haven't had any situations where we've had adamant regulators disagreeing with us.
Great. Has the Army implemented any land use controls on an MMRP site that overlaps current training areas?
Since the training area, I believe that all these MRSs that we're implementing are not on active ranges. So they're MRSs in which no current activity is happening. I hope that answers the question.
That's great. We've got about 4 minutes for you. We've got one more. Could you explain quickly the ECA process that you're going through here?
So the ECA basically provides like the structure for the land use controls. It sets up, it basically identifies which of the MRSs that we're gonna apply the interim land use controls, and it provides a history of each of those installations. It identifies the regulatory framework, provides the installation description, and it also provides like past MMRP activities and project schedules, and then it kind of lays out the basis for the background of, you know, basically where the installation is, where the MRS is, here's everything that's been done at the site, and basically it adds in a lot of the information from the site inspections and the history that was provided in the site inspections. From there, it looks at the alternative, two alternatives, like I said, the no action and the land use control, and the land use control alternative, and it actually goes into costs. It looks at, you know, it assesses, it compares basically effectiveness of alternatives, the implementability of the alternatives, and then looking at some of the cost summary. I mean, obviously no action is not really going to cost you much. Just kind of sets up the framework too for, you know, which land use controls may be implemented given the history and the background of the site. And then that's, again, once that's in its draft final format, then it goes out for public review.
Great. Thank you. That's all we have right now for you specifically, unless something else comes in a minute. Thank you very much, Maria. Now we've got about 30 minutes, and I have to say this is probably the most numerous outstanding questions we've had when we've gotten to this point. I'm going to try to muddle through a handful of questions. I think we have at least one for each of the presenters, so hope you're on the line. Did Mr. Daniel make it back?
Yes, I just came back on. Thank you.
I've got a couple questions for you. One is, when will AEC publish the anticipated sites for work in FY14?
In terms of the contract plan?
Yes.
We'll be putting that probably by the middle of September. Some of the efforts are already on there from the current contract plan where a couple of actions were pushed over into 14. But we're right now putting the requirements together, and we'll be publishing that on the website within another 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay, great. And have you or AEC utilized remote sensing or satellite technology to assess risk, exposure, et cetera?
Not so much assess risk or exposure, but yeah, the LIDAR technology, that type of thing, to help narrow down or focus in on the ground on the impact areas.
Okay, and I think one last one. Are there issues? Have you received any feedback regarding any concerns with notices that the Army puts out for property transferred and regulatory concerns with land use controls as a remedy?
As far as transfer property goes, that's getting more into the BRAC side, and I'm not really involved in that. I know we have had properties go outside the Army with land use controls on them because of potential presence of MEC items. Ours is more, we're more focused on what the Army still controls or those areas right off the installation boundary that just happen to be, again, contaminated, or maybe the fence line changed over the years, property's been sold, but it's still an active site. We've gotten feedback from regulators on land use controls in terms of the ones, the property that we currently own. I don't think is much of a concern. The property that we don't own, as I mentioned before, we're focused more on looking at the risk and mitigating risk there rather than managing it, because we don't control that property. We can't necessarily put a land use control on a site that we no longer own. I mean, that would have to be voluntary by the current landowner. So we'll be looking at that more from a mitigation standpoint, a cleanup standpoint, more so than a land use control.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Pastorek, are you around?
I'm here, John.
All right. What is your perspective or regulatory opinion on the use of UFP QAP or experiences you've had with the implementation of the QAP at a munitions site?
Not a regulatory opinion because, as I said, I'm not a regulator, but I have a definite, you know, a technical position on that, and that is that I personally love the UFP QAP. All of the it solves, if you follow that guidance, the Uniform Federal Policy for Quality Assurance Project Plans, if you follow that guidance, and it's gaining more and more acceptance, and I think hopefully it's going to become a requirement for munitions response, if you follow that, it virtually eliminates the problems with redundancy, repetition, and you know, duplication of effort, and all of the errors caused in that, because if you follow the worksheet process, it makes you say it once and say it right. So I'm looking forward to seeing it more and more. And every time I have seen it, I found it very beneficial to the project.
Thank you. And I'll add a note from a USAID's perspective on that as well. We have, as you all know, it's been a long, arduous process of updating our engineering manual 1110-14009, soon to be published as EM 200-1-15. There's a big transition from the 4009 to this revision, and that is going away from the standard work plan format that we have all known and loved for years to the UFP QAP. Now, I can also say the older versions of the worksheets are and were very cumbersome to use. They were repetitive in nature based on the very nature of how they put those together and how they believed that those worksheets would be used by project teams. It turned out that those types of things didn't actually pan out. So the working group had gotten together over the last year or so and have streamlined those worksheets to hopefully reduce all those redundancies and make them a little easier to use. Now, the next step from a USAID's perspective is we are also developing a little bit of training on that and some annotated worksheets for your use, and hopefully that'll make the transition from your standard work plan to use of the UFP QAP much easier. So that's where we're going with regarding the QAP. Let's see, Jim, got another one for you, I think. Let me find it. Oh, you mentioned the three-phase inspection process in your presentation. What is the recommended guidance document?
Guidance. Nothing, I don't, as I recall, nothing specific to munitions response. But, and I don't know, I mean, it's been around for years. I don't know who the first person that started using it, but I don't know. Do you know, John, is that a requirement for the Corps? I don't think it is.
It's not. It is a very valuable tool to use from a QA perspective as far as developing your QC plans and things. I would point people to the ITRC QA document. Probably discusses that a little bit, if I recall.
Yeah, I mean, it does. But even that's, you know, that's not a guidance or anything binding. I don't know of anything. I don't think know of anything in your DIDs or anything that says you must do, you know, use the three-phase inspection. Although once you become familiar with it, it makes perfect sense, and is a great way to go. I've seen it referenced in other, like, general core construction quality documents. I don't think I've ever found it as a requirement for munitions response. It's just sort of something that I think the industry has sort of gravitated to and used because it makes so much sense.
I would agree with you. Let me see. What else have I got for you? Let's see. That might be all I have for you.
No, I just sent you one.
All right, hang on. We've got another one in incoming news here. It hasn't popped up yet. All right, is it here?
Yeah, it was that one. Nope. Keep going down. There's more down there.
There's more down here. Hang tight, folks.
I'll be here to the end, John. If you want to come back to it later, that's okay, too.
We've got it here. Here's a question. You assume basically two types of QESPs. One is high level but not specific to definable features of work, and then those that are more specific to QA for definable features of work. Which do you expect to see in the QA plans?
Well, in my presentation, I said we rarely ever get to see the actual QASP. That is, to my understanding, between the core and the contractor. And we see QC plans, but we don't see the QASP. And that's usually not shared with the regulators because it's the core and your contractor. I'm advocating more transparency there. And my knowledge of QASP comes from your 4009 document that you just referenced, John, and that describes it for munitions response projects.
Is Carol and or Mike still with us?
Yes.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Mike should be there, too. Mike, you there?
Yep, he's there. I've got a question. Regarding what technology did you use at Martha's Vineyard to track the diver's precise location?
I'm assuming that's the ocean surf zone?
I believe so.
Okay. We had survey points on the beach, known point, and with the Jackstay line, we ran a bearing from that survey point. The Jackstay line was calibrated in 10-foot increments. So the diver was able to locate himself at a distance from the known point, and we had the known point and the bearing out.
Okay. What were the results of any sediment MC sampling or biota tissue that you conducted?
Okay. The MC sampling was designed an interred approach, and there was no tissue sampling at this point. The sediment results we got had very, very low results. They're still in the process and are not finalized yet, but they were very low results and predominantly a few metals, mostly associated with duck hunting.
Okay. How many USO items were found during the RIs and at which sites? And there's a follow-on. And based on those findings, what's your planned strategy to complete the CERCLA process at each of the sites?
Okay. What we had, Carol actually asked me to put a little cheat sheet together before the call. For Cape Pogue, during the TICRA, there were no mech items found and 127 munitions debris items found. During the RI investigation, there were 88 mech items and 325 MD items. For South Beach, there were no mech items found during the TICRA or the RI. There were 617 MD items found during the TICRA and 97 during the RI. And for Tisbury Great Pond, there was no TICRA. We found 6 mech items and 31 MD items. Where this is going, we're at draft final with the RI report for South Beach. We're at just submitted the draft RI report for Tisbury Great Pond. All of the reports have recommended at least partial areas within the sites to proceed to FS, and then from there they'll go to proposed plan and decision document. Did I answer that right, Carol?
Yes, it did.
All right, great. Thank you. Is Kevin on the line?
I am, yes.
You're on the hot seat now. On your slide number 4, on featured extraction, you had the 2 pictures, one of an ordnance item, one of a non-ordnance item, and kind of explaining the rock curves. Does the orientation of the UXO affect secondary polarization?
No, it really doesn't. The polarizability should be independent.
We have some good questions for you here. We got to move up. Wow, you guys send lots of questions. Where's that one at?
Down here.
That one.
Yep.
All right, here we go. What is a reasonable failure rate for identifying an ISO on an, quote, easy site and a tough site? And then given that, what would be an acceptable corrective action, you know, reanalysis, rework, et cetera, if a seed item is missed?
Yeah, I think we really should be able to get all of the items. And you saw a couple cases where I indicated one was missed. And I think that, you know, you need to do sort of a root cause analysis and look at, like, the scenario. First of all, look at the data. Was there an issue with the data? And you know, that scenario I mentioned where sort of all three analysts had missed one seed. Typically, you think, well, if all three people applying independent methods missed the same one, is there something wrong with the data? And if that's not the case, and you know the target's well positioned, then you have to look at just the scenario, like in the case of where a frag pit with an ISO in it, maybe that's just something that is you know, being able to classify that as an ISO in that scenario, it may have just been beyond the capabilities, and so. It's a question of, you know, your QC seeds, really, they're put in there. You know, the goal is to ensure that your procedures are functioning, your equipment is functioning, and that you're able to detect them. And I think certainly with that scenario, it was detected, and it was more a problem, I guess, with the classification, failing to identify that as a target of interest. And so that really, you know, pushes the envelope, I think, of what I'm not sure I have any real solution as to how that was just a very difficult target scenario, I think, is what it came down to.
Okay, great. All right, bear with me. I got a long question for you here, so give me a second here to read it to you. So as industry continues to evolve from digging everything, you know, mag and dig, to dig items above a certain threshold, you know, the basic EM61 approach, to advanced EMI and classification software, the ultimate safety of the site after remedial action is being focused to a single individual, the advanced classification geophysicist who processes the data and decides what is, you know, safe and what is not safe. Does the panel see professional liability being assumed by the geophysicist, you know, requirements for state registrations to certify the safety of the site, that kind of thing?
It's an excellent question. I mean, I would certainly argue that when you're looking at it's not exclusive to classification. If you imagine, let's say we're going back to mag and dig or just to EM61 dig above threshold, there's equally likely in each of those stages that something could be missed. You know, there's certainly you saw examples of with the EM61 and some of the inherent smearing of targets. You might miss a target that's just not picked because of the limitations of the data quality. So I would say that you're probably no more likely to miss something with classification. And in terms of if you're using this dynamic data, which has higher resolution, you're probably less likely. But it's true that in the end, it does come down to the person doing the classification and submitting that dig list. And I would say that I think that's why it's critical to have QA digs done independently as well, have someone else review that dig list. And you know, either give it sort of a second expert stamp level of approval or say, you know what, I want to dig these additional 10 items or I want to go beyond their stop dig point by X digs, just, you know, as confirmation. And so I think really the answer to that is you probably don't want one person being in control of this final dig list. You want to have oversight and the person that's qualified doing some QA on that dig list.
Okay. For the library that you use, is that ESTCP developed?
Yeah, what we'll do is typically with the ESTCP program, how they work their sites you'll get the data and you'll select a few items. Like you may have some history of the site or you know what's there, but you'll actually review these polarizabilities and look for these targets that are axisymmetric. So you can start with a library, like we'll start with a library that's maybe, you know, fairly large in terms of looking for things that match. One of the things I didn't mention is in Huntsville, I think we're talking about having like a centralized repository of a library of these features, which I think is a great idea, and sort of embed those into the software such as Geosoft's UX Analyze. But, you know, one of the things you want to do is your library, you also have to keep in mind that you may have an item on your site that's not in your library. And so one of the key things that I didn't really have time to get into is you want to be able to look for self-similar polarizability, so something that doesn't match anything in your library, but if you have four or five items that look virtually identical and they have this axisymmetric character, you'd be wanting to get some training data on at least one of those items to verify what that target is.
Okay, great. I think we got one more for you. How effective would MetalMapper be if you are dealing with a range that has been used for various activities and shows soil mixing to 18 inches with mech interlaced with MD, miscellaneous debris, and small arms?
It was a mixed use site and there was, you said there was soil mixing?
That's the question. I'm assuming there's just all those various items subsurface.
Sure. Certainly we've seen the metal mapper at various sites do very well with a range of mech items. Where the main challenges would come, I guess, with the metal mapper, it's kind of the same caveat that applies to all sensors, and that's specifically, you know, some of these magnetic soils that have frequency-dependent susceptibility. I would say that the metal mapper and these next-generation EMI sensors have an advantage because they have these multiple component receivers, and it turns out that some of those components are less sensitive to soil effects than other ones. So versus in the M61, it has at least that going for it, but it's still a challenge with the data quality. And the second challenge really is a highly cluttered site. So you can imagine what we want to do if we're collecting cued metal mapper data is we want to position our target over our item that we picked from a detection map and collect high quality cued data. And so if we end up having three or four items under our sensor because it's just a highly cluttered site, that's going to be a challenge. Certainly, the metal mapper, when you do multi-source inversions on the data, you can handle multiple objects in the field of view. But you know, as it gets more and more cluttered, you come to a point where you may have diminishing returns. And the other case I've seen is some of the data I think recently came in from Fort Rucker where there's really a high number of TOI on the site. So I think at that site there were rocket motors. And so it was just an unusually high percentage of the targets on the site were considered targets of interest. So, you know, you have to debate if you're going to wind up digging a majority of these targets anyways because they all need to be removed, what's the value? You'll be able to reduce your number of digs, certainly, but, you know, it's a cost-benefit analysis at that point of the, if the classification is adding value.
We got one last question, Kevin, it came in. On your next-to-last slide, where you show the charts for reduction in excavations, we talked about 80% fewer excavations. Did that include MD?
Did that include MD? Yes, it's every basically it's the only things that are considered targets of interest on these sites are basically intact UXO, or occasionally there's munitions debris, but it's just, you know, it's so close to an intact UXO that it's considered something that should be dug. So, you know, it's a nearly full ordnance that may be called scrap items that may have been from an ordnance.
You're a popular guy, Kevin. Got another question for you.
Sure.
And then we'll call it a day. Is there a ballpark target density, you know, anomalies per acre that is considered too cluttered?
That's a good question. And this would probably be a question better answered by Herb Nelson or some of these folks at ESTCP who've been setting up these demonstrations. I'd be kind of guessing if I was to come up with a number off the top of my head, but I would say it's basically, you know, you want to be able to differentiate individual targets, both in your detection map and you know, to get over cued measurements. So as long as you're not really grossly exceeding that, then you should be fine. And you may, what may happen is you may have areas of your site where it's just, you know, the data is geophysically masked. I think I saw some data at one point, and there were literally, you know, parts of an aircraft, like wings of an aircraft beneath the surface. So you can imagine with that amount of metal, you're not going to be able to see if there's anything underneath it. And at that point, you know, you're just going to have to, you're going to have to dig that area. But as long as you can get distinct anomalies, I think that's the sort of levels you have to look at in terms of the practicality of applying classification.
Great. Good stuff, Kevin. Appreciate it. Well, with that, we will wrap up today's session. But first, I can't express enough our thanks and appreciation to all the speakers today and for the other sessions this fiscal year, as well as all of your participation on these. You have made these very, very successful. And with that, we anticipate having another successful year next year. So please, if you have ideas, topics you would like to have on an agenda in the future, let us know. And by all means, we are always looking for speakers. Don't be afraid as you participate in these things. It's pretty easy going. And up on your screen, again, are the sessions that we're going to be offering next year. So keep those topics in mind and those dates, mark them down. Keep going back to the site occasionally for registration. It's not quite open yet, so be ready when it does. And please, pass the word, be our ambassadors. And thank you for your time and participation today. And Jean, thank you. Back to you.
Thanks. Great. Thank you so very much. I want to echo your thanks for both organizers, presenters, as well as the over 260 individuals who were able to join us for today's live broadcast from around the country. We do hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. And before I close things out today, I just want to walk everyone through a few final reminders. If you'd like to download electronic copies of the materials or take a look at some of the other resources that were gathered for today's talks, you'll find them on something called the Resources or Link page. That's actively hyperlinked on the slide that I've got pulled up. It's also available under related URLs. Again, if you're replaying the recording, those related URLs are active hyperlinks. Just click on Seminar Resources and then press the Browse To button. We'd also ask if you could take just a moment to fill out the short feedback form for today's live broadcast. We do read each and every one of those submissions, and that does help to continue to offer free online sessions like this. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can fill out your own feedback form. Just simply fill out the form, and there'll be a link that appears to let someone else fill out their own submission form. Again, that's also under the related URLs. It's actively hyperlinked on slide 14. You'll also find that on the seminar homepage. And I've also included those URLs in the Q&A pod in the lower right corner. If you're looking for credit for joining today's webinar, either through a training certificate or CEU or PDH, we don't necessarily issue those types of certificates directly through Cluin. However, many of our participants are able to earn those credits for taking our sessions. If you save the registration email and a copy of the agenda, which again you'll find on the seminar homepage, as well as perhaps electronic copies of the materials that were presented, and then fill out the feedback form, there is a box you can check, it's circled in red on the illustration, to request a confirmation email to be sent to you for your own records. As long as your email address is entered correctly, you will automatically get an email when you submit the feedback, at least verifying you shared your feedback thoughts after the live delivery. You can also try the same tactic if you're replaying the archived version of today's session. You often find if you gather those materials together, that's enough to verify your participation with your crediting institution or organization. Today's session was recorded and will automatically be archived on the Cluin website. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to post it, and anyone who signed up for today's live broadcast will receive that email as soon as the session is available, and you're certainly welcome to forward that on to someone that you think will find it useful. So that's the end of the formal reminders I have for everyone for today's broadcast. Again, thank you all so very much for joining us, and we hope to see you or hear from you on a future Cluin seminar.